Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew, and if this is September 15th, 2013, then we are live. Coming to you from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains. This is where the past meets the future. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. So, whether you are driving across the country tonight or working on your favorite project, we might go places that are a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely driving with us. So, recline your chair, look out the window, because we are about to launch another hour of X Squared Radio. Tonight, we have Diana West coming on. She was on, as you know, in July, and with her introduction of her blockbuster book, American Betrayal. And since that time, she has taken a lot of flack from academics of various locations in the Ivy League, and she has been valiantly defending herself in the press, and we have been reading very carefully as she has been doing that. With much interest, because we believe that Diana West is dead on the money. You're going to learn what that is about tonight. But first, don't forget the solar wind is a mile 395 kilometers per second, but the big news is the big snooze. With the sun's disk almost completely devoid of sunspots, solar flare activity has come to a complete halt. Measurements by NOAA's GOES 15 satellite show that the sun's global X-ray emission, a key metric of solar activity, has, for all intents and purposes, flatlined. It's brain dead. Also, researchers have long waited for one of the Voyager probes to leave the solar system. And in a surprising turn of events, NASA announced on Thursday of this week that Voyager 1 entered interstellar space a whole year ago. This event sets in motion a new era of exploration of the realm between the stars. And we, of course, will keep you posted right here on X Squared Radio. What they find, what comes back, what does V'ger find out there? By the way, also in from the NOAA and other independent sources, there has been a 67% increase in sea ice over the last year. We have been telling you that all global glaciers have been growing for the past 3 years, and now the sea ice is taking off again. The Northwest Passage never thawed this summer. And also in a global announcement, and I've already cleared this with the board of the North Pole Inner Earth Expedition, I have officially resigned as the expedition leader due to business requirements. Need to spend a lot more time doing something else now. It's been 7 years. I've put a lot into it, taken nothing out, and I've enjoyed every day of it. I've enjoyed meeting you, traveling the world, speaking about it, giving lectures about it. I have enjoyed it immensely. I have no regrets whatsoever, and I will continue to support the team from the sidelines from now on. Someone else will take the helm, and he or she will have 100% of my support whenever they need it. We'll make the website official this week, and we will transfer webmaster responsibilities to the next administration. So if you have any questions about that, you can write me at bagnew@x2-radio.com. I would be happy to answer any and all inquiries that come in. We want you to be part of tonight's show. Anywhere in North America, toll free 888-429-5471. Anywhere else on planet, you can reach us at 530-413-9537. And never forget that we have the Free conference line, 805-399-1000 with the passcode 769-608-pound. You can listen by cell phone. You won't be able to talk back to us, but you can listen to everything that's going on. If you want to talk back, you need to either call in one of the numbers, or you can reach me on Skype at X2-Radio, or you can call into the program via Skype at BBS Radio. Should be easy to get through. By the way, tonight in about 30 minutes, if you're just tuning in, we have the dynamic headliner, Diana West, coming on the program. If you listen to July's archives, you know that Diana is the author of American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character, came out on the St. Martin's Press this summer. And she's also the author of The Death of the Grown-Up, How America's Arrested Development is Bringing Down Western Civilization in 2007. Her weekly newspaper column is syndicated by Universal UClick, and she also serves as Washington correspondent for the European weekly newspaper Dispatch International. West is one of 19 co-authors, including Frank Gaffney, Andrew C. McCarthy, and James Woolsey, of Sharia, The Threat to America, a 2010 publication of the Center for Security Policy. She came on X Squared Radio for a magnificent 2.5-hour interview, and we talked about the real depths and implications of her factual publication about the de facto Soviet invasion of Washington, D.C. during World War II. If you didn't know about that, you are about to have your history books rewritten in your own home, in your own mind, and you need to read American Betrayal, and you need to stick around for the rest of this interview. This interview, as well as her ongoing column, opened up a battle between her and Ron Radish, and it has become the stuff of an all-out war of words in the press. Ron Radish is a PJ Media columnist and adjunct fellow at the Hudson Institute. Ron is a professional historian and author or co-author of more than 15 books. He became a PJ columnist in 2008 and has since provided his readers with sensible conservative analysis of where we are and what we have to do to get our nation back on course, in his opinion. In my analysis, he is a highly opinionated commentator and presents it as fact. I have read with more than just entertainment the chess match between these two famous authors. Diana's book, American Betrayal, uses actual hard records to reveal that the Soviet invasion we long feared as schoolchildren and watched in the 1984 movie Red Dawn actually happened. Oh, they didn't parachute into Montana skies and start rounding up Americans. They didn't have to. They arrived in Washington, D.C. by the thousands and put on their Sunday best and became the intelligence behind Roosevelt, who was a former New York governor, made for TV president, and headed up the agency government that supposedly saved the country from the Depression. The result was to set up an 80-year process of capturing America without firing a shot. It was a process of making a majority of the population workers of the state, obfuscating private enterprise and small businesses until the entire nation was wadded up with red tape, fines, taxes, and enforcement actions so that they could not move. We can't move money. We can't form new businesses. We cannot speak our minds. We cannot travel in our own country without being stripped, searched, photographed, traced, tracked, eavesdropped, and DNA'd to the last child. During my last interview with Diana West, I went a little beyond the last chapter of her landmark book, American Betrayal. I asked a couple of questions that joins the past and the future, which is what we do here at X Squared Radio. I asked her if Valerie Jarrett was Obama's Harry Hopkins. Harry was the co-president with Roosevelt and ensured the Soviet occupation of Eastern Europe by manipulating the American armed forces during the war. I also asked if the Soviets ever left Washington. The answers were yes and no, in that order. Now the world needs to know that there are dark forces at work here. The planning has been multi-generational. The cost has been in the tens of trillions of dollars and in the tens of millions of deaths and the enslavement of hundreds of millions of people. The organizers of this effort do not give up. They never sleep. They have no mercy on human life. They will stop at nothing and will use every twist and dodge to make sure you cannot point a straight finger at anything or anyone. It is only complex because they make it so to the outside observer. What is going on month by month? Terror attacks in major cities, embassies, and all across the mainstream news is planned. It's scripted. It's rehearsed. Even the actor playing the president tried to step off the sidewalk a few times. The result was the arrival of no less than five major scandals, any one of which could remove him from office in disgrace and to the shame of the American people who let it happen. Oh, they are not fully developed yet. They are called phony scandals, but they are not. This is the way they work. You do what you're told, and they will betray you by locking you out of the getaway car if they even think you will express your own thoughts. So where does that leave us, we Americans, we free peoples of the earth? Let's start with the greatest headline of the civil war in Syria. What do you know about it? Have you been there? Have you ever been to Egypt? Some of you have. And I invite you to call tonight and express your thoughts or Skype me the message and I will share it for you. Toll free anywhere in North America, 888-429-5471. If you want to make a comment and you're outside the country, I welcome those comments as well. 530-413-9537. My Skype address, X2-radio. So let's hear from someone who has been on the real inside, who has visited the hospitals and the villages to talk to the people who are supposedly revolting against the wicked Assad regime. This is Mr. Tremblay. I'm just going to play part of his interview here because I think you will be enlightened. Here we go. Listen closely.
Surely not. Certainly, Mr. Lavrov is on very firm ground there. I've just completed about a one-week fact-finding tour of the country. I've been in Homs, I've been in Tartus, Banyas, I've been in the military hospital here in Baghdad, and I can tell you what average, everyday Syrians of all ethnic groups, Christian, Alawite, Sunni, Shiite, Druze, what they say about this is that they are being shot at by snipers. In Homs in particular, people complained that there are terrorist snipers who are shooting at civilians, men, women, and children, blind terrorism, random killing, simply for the purpose of destabilizing the country. I would not call this a civil war by any stretch of the imagination. I think that's a very, very misleading term. In the following sense, what you're dealing with here are death squads. You're dealing here with terror commandos, the kind of thing that everybody remembers from Argentina and the Central America. This is a typical CIA method. In this case, it's a joint production of CIA, MI6, Mossad, the DGSE of the French. It's got money coming from Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and Qatar. And it has a couple of interesting managers. The manager I think you should point to perhaps most is a guy called Khaddam. Khaddam was the foreign minister in this country for quite a couple of decades. He's almost 80 years old. He operates from Paris. And I think he's being groomed by NATO as the new dictator of some kind.
Mr. Tarpley, I'm sorry to interrupt you. If I could just jump in for a moment, it's very interesting how you bring in the issue of that there are unknown snipers, there are terror commandos, death squads with links to the West and the West's allies in Saudi Arabia, for example. But Assad's rule is increasingly being called illegitimate. But isn't the U.S. and that of Europe a concern that getting rid of the Syrian president could just cause even more violence? For example, what we're seeing right now in Tahrir Square in Egypt.
Well, after Libya becoming a bloodbath with 150,000 dead, and now with Egypt showing what it was all along, there was no revolution there. It was a complete failure, and now people are beginning to understand it. Notice that, nevertheless, Mrs. Clinton and Ms. Rice at the United Nations are continuing to push this bankrupt, discredited model of the color revolution, the CIA people power coup, backed up by terrorist troops, people from Al-Qaeda, people from the Muslim Brotherhood, people from Salafist organizations, and so forth. And I've heard this now from some very important religious authorities here. There's a growing movement inside the Islamic community here, which says we want reconciliation, we want law and order, we want legality, we don't want fat fanatics to run the show. The fanatics are being brought in by the Western powers.
So the fanatics are coming in by the Western powers. You're seeing a fair amount of unification, yes, among the Muslims there. But let's draw some comparisons, if we may. UN Resolution 1973 for Libya to protect civilians there. Do you think, is the grand plan here for Syria that of the Western states to get in there for regime in Syria? And if that is their plan, then what is the point? What is there to gain?
Very, very important thing is that this is the most tolerant society in the Middle East. This is one place where all kinds of people live together in, I think, remarkable harmony. And again, it's a very wide variety. Muslims of all kinds, Christians of all kinds, right? Christian, Greek Orthodox, Greek Catholics, Melkites, Syriacs, many, many other kinds, Druzes, Kurds, and so forth. This is a model of the peaceful coexistence of various ethnic groups. Now, the U.S. policy, I think, right now is to smash the Middle East according to ethnic lines. In other words, if you can have a divide and conquer policy, which says the Christians will be kicked out of Lebanon and the Christians will be, say, kicked out of Syria in the way that they have been kicked out of Iraq, and ironically, a lot of them went to Syria. You can get a situation where all of these countries are fatally weakened. The way in which it's introduced is, if you look at Syria, the main centers of trouble are on the Turkish border, the Syrian border with Jordan, with Iraqi Kurdistan, and then with Lebanon. And I think Lebanon, thanks to Saad Hariri, may be the main one.
We are running very, very long on time here.
Okay, they're running low on time in that part of the interview, and I don't want to share the back and forth with you between the interviewer on the news and Mr. Trumbly, but now who could be behind such a thing? He's talking about managers. Has this been done before? Yes, it has, he says. It is a plan, like Wars R Us has this organized thing that they do. They open the middle envelope and they deliver it, and then they conduct it. The question everyone has on their minds, and one of the reasons why Diana West's work is so powerful, because you see who the main player is, the grand organizer, the one who the press is putting out as the great hero to step in with his high-powered rifle and his fish and his big game hunting and his shirt off camo pants and combat boots, is none other than Mr. Putin. So Vladimir Putin is now the hero of the world, pulling everything together, and it is a marvelous thing to see these brilliantly written op-ed pieces hit the American press and get spread around like they have a publicist behind them, and to see this unfold. So the question on everyone's mind is there a plan behind what is going on? Well, Mr. Trumbly goes on with his report. I'm going to share this part with you, and you listen very closely.
Well, it's all the tactics of demagogy and the modulation of demagogy from one minute to the next. But what we have here in Syria is a cynical media campaign, because I've been in Homs. When you go to Homs and you go to the Zahra neighborhood, which is supposed to be the hottest point in the whole country, you find people who are pro-Assad. They're concerned, number one, about mazut. They want to have heating oil because the winter is coming and it's getting cold. And you ask them, what is your demand? They say, we want the Syrian army to come in here. We want the Syrian army posted on the roofs of the houses with helicopters and tanks. Stop these snipers from killing us. Don't let these black hooded figures, which is what they are, pretending to be deserters when they're really maybe from Chechnya, they're from Libya, they're from Afghanistan or Pakistan. Foreign fighters have been brought in here by the CIA and the other Western services, and that is what's going on. And that is, I think, a very, very large part of it. And in the city of Homs, for example, in one hospital, they were telling us it was 5 dead and 7 wounded on one day. And what was it? It's all snipers. It's all these terrorists who are shooting the civilian population. Of course, when Al Jazeera arrives, they say, oh, those deaths are the responsibility of the Syrian army. That is absolute baloney. This is a Goebbels big lie campaign. There is no civil war here. There is no insurrection. There is no mass political movement against Assad. These are very, very limited, minor, strictly localized phenomena. This looks nothing like Libya. I know what a civil war in a modern Arab country looks like. I've been in Libya during the summer. There's no civil war here. There's no fun.
As you say, there's no civil war here. As you are suggesting, this is simply a bout of terror commandos and death squads being exported by the CIA and brought in by other Western factions. But I'm afraid I wish we had more time for this. Author and journalist Webster Tarpley, live from Damascus.
All right, that was live from Damascus, so you get the idea. Now, I know you've read about Goebbels and his renowned skill for manipulating the populace through the press. Notice that I did not say manipulating the press. They are part of the plan as well. That is why free people get their real news and their real truth from outlets like X Squared Radio and others. The world is being played like puppets, and they have been for about 80 years. Now, they got close to flying planes over Syria to make sure the planners could take over the country of Syria for the financial backers in Saudi Arabia. I believe they are the financial backers, but I do not believe they are the brains behind the operations, behind unfolded scenes from Egypt to Libya to Syria. There's a higher intellect here that spans generations without wavering from its mission. And I'm saying that when this plan was put in place in 1933 and it was implemented, it did not waver much. The CIA, MI6, the Mossad, you think they're in charge? Hardly. Goons and assassins at best. My guest tonight, Diana West, has followed their trail far back into the 19th century. She has the facts. She knows the highest office operatives that used American boys for cannon fodder and American wives and mothers to prepare the meals, tend the wounds, and shed the tears for their master plan to take over the entire world and rule it. How many of you have heard the term rule of law? I think our own president has used it 12,000 times since we met him as a Johnny senator out of the streets of Chicago. Law is one thing. Lawmakers write that. Elected lawmakers. The thousands of regulations that are generated by the agencies under the sole discretion of the president are the rule. That agency government taxes you, fines you, confiscates your property, limits your movement and your ability to buy, sell, and trade. You have no representation in that government. It is the epitome of tyranny, and there is nothing you can presently do about it. It will take a constitutional convention to change it. By the way, I find it amusing that Mr. Levin writes a book called The Liberty Amendments a year after I wrote the number one Amazon bestseller, Alienated Nation, asking for exactly the same thing with the same nine amendments, right down to the National Guard Amendment, prohibiting the president from conscribing the National Guard for undeclared foreign wars. Mr. Levin, I have no problem with you copying my work. I only ask for a simple acknowledgement. A footnote here and there would do just fine. Or how about letting me talk about my book on your program? No? Well, there you go. Enough said. Let's bring on the author of American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character, and The Death of the Grown-Up, How America's Arrested Development is Bringing Down Western Civilization. Her weekly newspaper column is syndicated by Universal UClick, and she also serves as Washington correspondent for the European weekly newspaper Dispatch International. She is also a powerful and prolific columnist in multiple online newspapers where the world gets its real news. Please welcome with me Anna West. How are you, Diana?
I'm just fine, Brooks. How are you?
I am doing wonderful. In fact, as I said earlier in the program, I am much more than just entertained by the tremendous academic writing that has been going on in most of the major online newspapers between you and Mr. Ron Radish. And I'd like to flesh that out just a little bit tonight and get your thoughts about what's going on now in the world.
Fire away.
Well, in your book American Betrayal, you make some amazing, groundbreaking historical revelations to the people who have read it, and I think that revelation is slowly rippling its way through the psyche of America, and that is that the greatest generation, the one that fought World War I, got ourselves hip deep in the mud and tried to wrestle our way out of the quicksand and ended up in World War II, that as a people, as a nation, as an economy, we were manipulated from the inside. Can you bring us up to date a little bit how that happened? How did the Soviets get into Washington? How were they accepted? How did they accomplish what they were able to do?
They were geniuses at subversion. And this we know not just from the American experience. I mean, they were busy, busy people right from the start. As soon as the Bolsheviks took over the Russian Revolution, of course, Bolshevik means minority party. They were the minority. They took hold. They were in power. And really, as soon as they get started up and running, after they socialized medicine and so on, welcome to Obamacare, right? They move into an international stance with the Comintern, with all manner of infiltration around the world, in the Orient, in Europe, in America, and it is quite an extraordinary thing to go back and read about. I'm actually right now reading about the very famous Soviet agent Richard Sorge, who was a German-born Russian-Soviet spy, probably their greatest, and his success was in the Orient. He was very instrumental in Tokyo before the war. Over in our neck of the woods, we had Harry Dexter White, a Treasury official very close to Secretary Morgenthau in the Roosevelt administration. And the two of them, Harry Dexter White here, Richard Sorge in Tokyo, were able to pull off a tremendous coup in terms of bringing Japan and America to war, Pearl Harbor. And this was a great thing for the Soviets because it kept the Japanese then on the march from attacking Mother Russia. And this is just one incredible two-continent subversive story of subversion. But in America, it really got going in a big way once we normalized relations with the Soviet Union. And for me, I mean, their history, of course, goes back to the beginning of time, really. So you could say, when did this all start? And you have to go way back. But I decided for purposes of my book. I'm sorry?
was going to say, first the Earth cooled.
Yes, first the Earth cooled, and then we're off and running. But for purposes of, you know, trying to impose a structure and also trying to impose sort of a point of change, a point of difference, I do start with the recognition of the Soviet Union in 1933, which is an interesting thing because we already had four presidents and six secretaries of state before FDR came into office who said no, who said we will not recognize a nation, a government that is out to destroy us. It doesn't seem like a good idea. By the time you get up to 1933, the new president thought it was a good idea. And essentially, I do argue in American Betrayal, this required the American government to begin lying in a very institutional manner because that the predicate of this agreement was that the Soviet Union would not try to overthrow us, would not organize secret agents in our country to try to overthrow the Constitution, would not support said kinds of subversion, et cetera, et cetera. And indeed, it was already underway. And once you get this piece of paper signed, it grows to amazing proportions. So it was, to answer your question, it was in the 1930s under the Roosevelt administration where we see this entree into the federal government and related institutions by a number of American traders who were working with Stalin's interests, with communism's interests at heart. And this is where you see this, what I argue was like a de facto army of occupation, a secret army waging intelligence war against us, take shape.
Well, you know, what I find interesting, Diana, is that prior to 1933, you know, we go through the Roaring Twenties, we end World War One. You know, business is booming, investment is booming, the middle class is forming and it's getting legs and it's reinvesting in things. Hoover becomes president and it's like somebody just lets the air out of the balloon from behind the scenes. And now Hoover's an engineer. Like me, he tries to streamline things. He tries to, you know, eliminate all the duplicity in government and all the wasted effort. And it doesn't seem like anything goes forward. Like Congress and Senate just won't support anything. He can't get anything published. He can't get the American people behind him. And this is a time before, you know, global radio, before TV. I mean, it was really hard for a president to go out and hit the bully pulpit and get the American people behind his ideas. And Hoover just wasn't that kind of guy. But Roosevelt, being the governor of New York, he was larger than life. And when he came in, he had that celebrity status. But was he really that smart, or was he just, you know, a pair of glasses and a figurehead, and someone was behind him advising him everything to say, everything to do?
Well, that's an interesting question. You have to also remember that he was seriously handicapped. I mean, he had had polio strike him, and he could not move well. He was crippled, and he would have to be in braces, leg braces, that were very difficult for him to get around, and I'm sure it got harder as he got older. He was certainly in a wheelchair most of the time and very hard for him to move on crutches. And because of that, you had the creation of these top White House officials, these administrative assistants that were essentially created, these positions in the White House were essentially created to provide this particular president with more mobility of, in a way, by these aides who were able to move around and talk to people and get out and do things and cover certain things that would be difficult for him due to his physical problems. One of these in particular, became a very famous Soviet agent named Lachlan Curry. So this was sort of, you could see, as a result of his own physical infirmity, there were certain ways he could be manipulated. He could be, he was almost a captive audience in some sense, by his aides. And I think that that's something to bear in mind as we see his presidency evolve. That physical infirmity actually had consequences. There also is something in his character, and I don't know if it predates, you know, his polio or not, but he always seemed to want a very, very close aide, someone who actually lived with him. And he had that in a couple of places, a couple of men, and then the very famous one would be Harry Hopkins, who actually lived in the White House for 3.5 years with him as his top aide after a previous top aide, I believe it was Louis Howe, died. So he had had someone before that. I don't know if Louis Howe actually lived in the White House, but he was always, always there. And then you actually have Hopkins, himself an ill man, who, so maybe that was in some way a way they bonded, I don't know. But, you know, two very interesting figures relying on each other, and then again, the big man being perhaps preyed upon or at least manipulatable due to this unusual physical existence he had. So that's another thing to bear in mind. He certainly relied very heavily on staff, and as he became more ill, and probably much more ill than the American people were ever allowed to know, these staffers and various people around him actually did appear to take greater and greater liberties with him. And if it was a Soviet agent, that was a problem. So, you know, this is,
you know,
way to consider it.
I was recalling watching the movie Pearl Harbor, which was a remake of, you know, like Tora, 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 whatever. But the thing that I noticed about that movie is that Roosevelt would wheel into the room with literally hundreds of photographers with flashbulbs at the ready. And then he would struggle himself up out of the chair onto the podium and lock his braces in so he could stand there straight up. They would pull the chair away, and then the cameras would flash. And what I noticed there is that there was not the investigative reporting going into the weaknesses of the presidency then as there is now. Although I have to say that if any of the press corps stands up and really asks the president a hard question, not only will he be quickly ushered out or shut down by the president, but he never gets to ask another question. So it's a little bit like there was asbestos insulation between what was going on in the White House and what was allowed to be seen by the American people. Admittedly, it was tough times. I mean, we had been attacked at Pearl Harbor, and we had a dreadful responsibility in Europe, which half the country didn't even want us to honor. And so we're fighting on two sides of the planet and dividing, you know, all of our resources and all of our men. And lo and behold, the American men, young men, stand up and begin enlisting, and they support the cause, and they give their lives by the hundreds of thousands for this.
Yeah. Yeah, it was, you know, definitely dire times. I think, though, that the thing that really shocked me was that there was no more effort made to assist the Americans in the Pacific. And this is something that actually shocked the British as well, who, once the Americans were attacked at Pearl Harbor, actually imagined that naturally our emphasis, our priority, would go toward relief of MacArthur and the men in the Philippines. And this did not happen. And I think that is sort of kind of a shocking note that we don't tend to dwell on in the way we've been presented history. And I guess this is something that, in American Betrayal, I've started reapproaching many of the very familiar stories of the war, how it's taught, how we remember it, and kind of looking at them with new eyes and wondering, gee, I wonder what went into that decision. What were the American people told? The American people were actually told that MacArthur was going to be relieved, and so was MacArthur, but it didn't happen. And so you start wondering, well, why? And then you're looking at this tremendous effort to supply the Russians, who were fighting the Germans at the time, of course. And, you know, you just start asking questions. Well, I wonder how did that go down? Why was the Russian front more important than the American front in the Pacific? And, you know, these are the kinds of questions that I entertain in the book. And, you know, some of the questions have answers, and some of them we need a whole lot more research. So it's a matter of rethinking and repuzzling, and then sometimes actually finding an answer in the record that had been covered over. So it's a real grab bag in terms of what we know, what we've been told. But I think that the exercise certainly made me, just personally, as a journalist, more suspicious of our government, more concerned about the tendency of Americans today to take the word of authority. And I think that this is sort of the lesson for me of the book, is that we should not be doing this, and that we actually have much more right to know what's going on. And all along, this perhaps has been one of our great handicaps as a people that increasingly, starting particularly in the Roosevelt years, the government stopped telling us the truth. And I think that this has kind of only been repeated much, much more so going forward.
Yeah, I generally think that, or I want to believe, that the reason that the government doesn't tell us the truth is because they honestly believe we can't handle the truth, to steal a line. And I read your column last month where you had taken excerpts from the book and you were asking the question and trying to get the readers of your column to think about that question. Why were 150,000 troops left without supply, without backup? Why was MacArthur running bulldozers under fire to build airstrips, expecting planes that never arrived?
Yeah.
Why? I mean, we should ask that question.
I think so. I do think so. It is one of those questions where there are clues and there are just things to wonder about. Certainly, you start seeing the emphasis of a Harry Hopkins returning to Europe, returning to the European front, which, again, was Russians and Germans fighting, not Americans, and indeed not British at this point either, at least in Europe. So you do wonder about this, and you kind of start unpeeling the onion. You also see things like MacArthur coming up with, gee, I have a great idea. Let's get the Russians to help. They're so close. They could help out this way, that way, the other way. But, of course, the Russians and the Japanese remained at peace until one fateful week before the end of the war in the end of the war with Japan in 1945. But for the entire war, Russia preserved this peace with Japan, and they were not going to jeopardize that. So even though we were supposed to be doing everything possible for our alliance with Stalin, everything possible to help them, to relieve them, to plan our invasions of Europe and elsewhere and so on, and to give absolutely billions and billions of dollars to them in the process, the Russians didn't lift a finger to help our armies or the British in the Pacific. And again, that's another thing to say, well, gee, you know, what was up with that? It's again, these are sorts of questions that don't usually come up. One of the most shocking things I found out during my research was that with the very famous Doolittle raid of Tokyo, the firebombing raid of Tokyo, that was really our first strike at Japan, a very bold, heroic bombing run over Tokyo after Pearl Harbor, led by Doolittle, of course, Doolittle's raiders. One of the most shocking things I found was that one plane that was unable to follow the course to China, which at the time was an ally, nationalist China, had not been taken over by Mao, of course, at this point, it was Chiang Kai-shek's China. And our planes were actually trying to get there to land and be taken care of. One plane goes off course and ends up in Vladivostok, and the crew is incarcerated and spent the next year in Soviet incarceration, badly treated. They had to go, you know, in labor camps. They weren't fed well. They were eating cabbage soup. They were getting dysentery and all manner of, you know, illness and so on. And ultimately, they were able to escape via Iran. And believe it or not, I mean, it was a hairy escape that they were able to do. And they got actually their freedom led through a British consulate in Iran. So they were able to get home. But this was something that I was absolutely appalled by. Here we are again, an ally in this war, doing all this manner to support Russia's cause, and they're holding our men. I mean, it's sort of staggering. And then meanwhile, we're generating that absolutely wonderful movie, 30 Seconds Over Tokyo, which is the fabulous dramatization of the Doolittle Raid that was actually written by one of our famous communist screenwriters, Dalton Trumbo, one of the Hollywood Ten. I think it's probably his best movie, that you know, glorifies the raid. And then meanwhile, their brother raiders are languishing in a Russian, incarceration. I mean, it's again, something that you don't think about, and you have to say, why? How did we let this happen? Why couldn't we say, hey, get our guys out of there. What are you talking about? We're not going to give you the next 100 airplanes if you don't get our guys out. But no, nothing was done.
Well, and it went beyond that, too. I mean, at least
well, sure,
those guys may have survived. But one of the most amazing things that you put in the book. I mean, the thing that, that you were talking about on a book TV on C-SPAN when I first saw your interview, and the reason I called you for the first interview was because you revealed in that interview that some 15,000 to 20,000 Americans, and I don't know how many allied, were actually held in Soviet gulags after the war. And these were individuals that, you know, were shot down. They were airmen. They were pilots. They were crews and support crews that were in German prisoner of war camps, but they weren't liberated after the war. They were continually held in captivity, and Roosevelt and Eisenhower denied that they even existed.
Yeah. Well, they had the misfortune to be liberated in quotation marks by the Red Army, and this would have been all of the Allied troops held in not all, but many of the Allied troops held in Eastern Reich prisons, Eastern German Nazi prisons during the war. Yes. Well, this is the logic. This is where you look at the document trail, and you just say, well, this is what the documents are telling us. And again, there has been no real reckoning as to what these documents say. And these were documents that were diplomatic cables, military cables, written by the principal actors. It's all primary source material that actually were pulled together in a really amazing report done by staff on the minority staff at the time on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee back in 1990, and anyone can download it. It is available online, and you can actually read it. It's not a overlong report. It's a very well-written, well-crafted, with lots of quotations from these various cables. And the thing you allude to, and the thing that I just keep coming back to and, you know, saying, well, that's what it says. I don't know where to go from here because we've never really dealt with it. But in May of 1945, and this was coming after months, probably more than 6 months, maybe 9 months, of frustrated negotiations between the Americans and their Russian counterparts trying to figure out prisoner of war swaps. And our representatives were continually frustrated by the non-cooperation of the Soviets. What else is new, right? I mean, this has always been our pattern. But as we're coming toward the end of the war, this is becoming extremely important, and you do see frustration expressed by our American ambassador at the time to Moscow, Averill Harriman, in Moscow, and our chief military negotiator, General John Dean, who were just meeting brick walls on this. What we wanted to do as the war was winding down in that spring, and the British as well, was send in rescue teams, planes with medical personnel and so on to go and scoop up our men who were at this point wandering the roads of Europe, Eastern Europe, into Russia, Poland, sick, wounded. They'd been in prison camps for years. I mean, this was a dire situation, and Stalin would not let this happen, and this was the cause of great frustration. And then as we come to the end of the war, you've actually got, you know, DE Day in May of 1945, and then you have a negotiation between the Americans and the Soviets over this that is the cables tell a terrible story, where the American negotiator is actually coming to a realization that our men aren't coming home anytime soon. And you read this and you say, oh my gosh. And then at the same time, you're seeing numbers coming out. You've got the Surgeon General under Eisenhower at Supreme Allied Headquarters Command comes up with a number of something like 20,000 men. He still believes in late May of 1945, like Memorial Day weekend, you know, end of May 1945, still in Soviet hands. Out of Moscow, you have General Dean, who comes up with a very specific figure, something around the line of 15,500 and some, and he actually comes down to a real, you know, like a seven, or, you know, a very specific number. The six-digit number ends in a very specific number, so it's not even a generalization. What he has, according to records, indicates our men in custody of Soviet hands. So between 15 and 20,000 on that final weekend of May, and then 24 hours later, General Eisenhower, then Supreme Allied Commander, issues a statement, a cable, announcing that all of our men have basically come home and we will only be seeing stragglers from here on end. That is also, at the same time, you get an announcement out of the War Department in Washington to the same effect. all the men we've carried is missing in action all this time. Basically, we know, I'm so sorry to say, they are dead. We will be seeing stragglers from here on end. And so you look at this cable, you look at the two men trying to figure out, you know, numbers. You've got the Surgeon General and you have the military negotiator, and it's in the thousands. And then you have Supreme Allied Commander say, all of a sudden, there's nobody. And then, sure enough, nobody's coming home. You get stragglers. But as the years go by and various people are coming back from the gulag, whether they were slave laborers like Germans who were part of the Yalta Agreement to go slave labor for the Soviet Union, another charming development of the war, they're coming out and being debriefed, and they're reporting there's several officers here, there's some Americans in a mining camp, a mercury camp, a silent camp, a this, and you're starting to get anecdotal information about men who were presumed missing in action, then changed to killed in action. And then in 1955, someone says, oh, I saw, you know, this man from Richmond, Virginia, and this information doesn't get out. It doesn't get out. And so it stayed bottled up. The families didn't think to question it. And so you look at the documents and you say, is that what happened? And sure enough, over the years, you have a lot of anecdotal information. We still don't really know. They even, you know, finally come out with a report in 2005 that says, yes, there were men from every conflict. American men remains in the gulag after World War II, Korea, Cold War, Vietnam. Yes, it's true. But we really don't have, like, a huge reckoning of this. And the numbers are very fudgy. You know, we still don't really know. And we've certainly never had a president say, this is what happened. So
well,
it kind
no.
of...
No, we have. I mean, it would be a little bit like admitting that we've been covering up UFOs for 50 years.
Yeah. And why didn't they negotiate for them ever?
Yeah, exactly. And you can understand Roosevelt. He was getting old. He died in office. He was, you know, probably a little mentally infirm after his first term.
Yeah.
But Eisenhower was not a cripple, and he was, you know, intimately knowledgeable about the military-industrial complex.
Yeah.
I don't understand how he passed up the greatest ticker tape parade in history, bringing those prisoners of war home, with a country that ostensibly we were not at war with in 1945. We were allies.
Well, it was very hostile. You know, at the longer that this alliance went on, the more hostility there was. And the more appeasing there was. I mean, one thing I was really shocked, another thing that was an interesting parallel today is, you know, we always are hearing about, oh my gosh, we mustn't offend the Muslims. Oh my gosh, we mustn't offend Islam. Well, I was just amazed to find how often that statement came up in regard to the Russians. Oh my gosh, we mustn't offend the Russians. Oh my gosh, we have to appease the Russians. It was the same kind of pressure that if you wouldn't kowtow to the Russians, they might, you know, blow up at you or set off or leave the alliance. And this became kind of a blackmail that affected our policy very deeply. And so I think that Eisenhower was one very susceptible to that. There were other generals, as I understand it, who would like to have looked for the men. I think I've heard, I'm not an expert on, you know, I'd like to do more study on this, frankly, but I've heard that, some, for example, Patton was very concerned about this, but of course, He was killed, you know, at the end of the war, and you know, he died, it's a really hard thing to even mentally grasp. I mean, in this way, it is for my book the ultimate American betrayal. Obviously, even though there are other betrayals that cost more lives.
Yeah. I mean, if you think about, you know, his military prowess and his leadership, really the only effective mech units in the entire war were sent to Africa to cut off the Nazi fuel supply. And they were successful. They beat, you know, some of the great military minds like Rommel, and they beat their way all the way through North Africa, crossed the Med. They're sitting in Italy, ready to go up into the soft underbelly of Europe and end this war. You had them right there, battle ready, fully supplied, healthy guys, successful in their African campaign. And then what happens?
Well, we pull out of Italy to reinvade France, to reinvade Europe via France.
That sounds brilliant.
Well, isn't that a funny thing? I mean, I came across that in, there's a very good book by Dennis Dunn, who's a history professor who wrote an excellent book about the first five American ambassadors to Moscow. It's called Between Roosevelt and Stalin, Caught Between Roosevelt and Stalin. And that was where I first read that whole concept, and I was completely floored. I had never thought of that. I always had thought of the Normandy invasion as our invasion of Europe. This is what we've been waiting for, this climactic moment where all America and Britain invade the continent. And then you're reading along, you're reading about, yes, going from North Africa, and you know, you're reading about Tunisia and Sicily and Italy, and then you read about, for example, General Mark Clark's memoir, because he was our commander in Italy, and you read about how he's losing men and material and machinery and landing craft and all of this stuff for the invasion of France. And then you read back to Dennis Dunn, and he has this little line. So in other words, paradoxically, we withdrew from Europe in order to reinvade Europe at the Northwest. And then you start thinking, that's strange, isn't it? Or maybe it's not. I don't know. I'm not a military strategist. But then you start seeing that there were a number of military strategists, great generals, important generals, including Winston Churchill, not least, who were desperate to continue up the middle through the Balkans and other places in that, you know, that phrase, the soft, I don't know how soft the underbelly of Europe really was, but just through the middle rather than leaving and coming back in the Northwest in France. So it's an interesting conundrum.
I say soft because there weren't any pillboxes. They weren't dug into the cliffs, you know, looking out to the sea, you know, where they could just sit there and just run guns until the barrels melted down and just mow people down on the beach, which they did.
They could have pushed
their up through there. And I think from our last interview, I recall that even the Germans were totally thrown off that we withdrew. They couldn't find us anywhere.
Yeah, they were looking. Yeah, they couldn't believe it because apparently they felt like we were moving in for the kill in terms of destroying the German armies in Italy. And when all of a sudden the Americans disappeared and other allies disappeared, they actually sent out scouts looking for them. You know, where'd they go? You know, where did they go? And we would actually capture various German spies or scouts looking for where the, you know, what incredibly crafty thing we must be planning for having withdrawn. It is a very strange conundrum again, I thought it deserved revisiting, trying to understand whether there had been Soviet influence on our policymaking chain. And so this is what I try to do in the book. And what I know is, I am not a military strategist. I'm not making military strategy. However, in terms of that Italian Balkan style invasion, you had General Eisenhower for it, which most people don't know. In fact, I'm not sure it's even in really any Eisenhower. I'm not sure if it's in any Eisenhower biographies. I did not come across it. However, it is in the State Department records of the Tehran Conference, which took place at the end of 1943. You have Eisenhower presenting his strategy exactly, sounded exactly like Churchill's, of going up through that southern eastern European way. You had General Eaker, you had General Spatz, you had General Mark Clark, you had Churchill, you had an array of important generals saying this is the way to go because we already have the airfields built, the Germans already built them, thank you, and we will already be able to do bombing runs and do whatever other kinds of excursions and you know, send vectors of forces into Germany from a much shorter distance. Now there were generals who thought it was not necessarily entirely a soft underbelly. General Wiedemeyer, for example, did believe that supply and so on through that very difficult terrain was going to pose a problem. So, for example, he was actually militarily against it. But you also had the political argument, and you know, the other generals thought there were ways around that physical problem. But you had the political argument, which was made very convincingly by, for example, there was an OSS official named John Wiley, who laid it all out for Roosevelt. William Bullitt, another Roosevelt official, a very brilliant man, laid it out for Roosevelt in terms of, if we are not in Central Europe, the Russians will be. And again, you have to say, why was this not a compelling factor? And, you know, you go back and you look at the influence on the policymaking chain, you say, well, the Russians didn't want us there. And I think that that becomes, has to go into the way we regard even this crowning moment of D-Day, because was D-Day the best idea, really? Was there Soviet influence in that decision? How does that factor into the way we look at our war? And do, can we really say the Cold War started after the war? Were we being played?
Right. You know, we really didn't have satellite technology then. We didn't have U-2s. No. We didn't have the ability to see what was going on. So there was this giant magic trick going on. Here, watch my left hand over here in France. And then my right hand is going to slam down through Central Europe. And before you know it, we're going to own half of Germany. And that's pretty much what happened. And there was a wall to tear down. Diana, let's take a quick break. Let stations do whatever they do. We'll take about a 4-minute break and we'll be right back after this. If you'll stay with me a little longer, I want to talk about the implications for modern day DC and where we're going, because there are some amazing things happening in the press almost on an hourly basis now.
Okay, sounds great.
Okay, we'll be back in about 4 minutes. Don't go away. Here we go. And welcome back to X Squared Radio. If you're listening to this September 15, 2013, we are live, coming to you from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains. My guest tonight is Diana West, the author of an incredible book called American Betrayal. And the most interesting things about the book, and I think the reason why you study history when you go through elementary school and junior high and high school and even in college, it's not to teach you how to hold an intelligent conversation at the water cooler. It's to give every citizen that goes to school in this country some hindsight about what price has been paid, what roads have been laid, what walls have been built, what foundations have been laid, so that you can, as the next generation of leaders, lawyers, politicians, company presidents, bankers, mayors, city council members, can lead the country forward having that history behind you, so that you know where we have been. Now, admittedly, history is written by and large by the victors. And that is why great journalists like Diana West have such an important role, to go back through that history, not the published history, the recorded history in the archives, in the annals and records deep in Congress and deep in libraries and original manuscripts, records, tapes, pictures, things like that, and put the pieces together so that we understand why the big picture happened the way that it did. And the reason that's important, I feel, and why you listen to X Squared Radio, because we want to explore these mysteries so we understand how it is we got ourselves in this trouble, maybe even possibly who was behind it and where they were going with it. And so we find ourselves almost repeating with the same players this charade that we went through with so many hundreds of thousands of lives and countless trillions of dollars in capital that could have been spent doing other things besides breaking things and killing people. We've been doing it now for over 80 years, and I think it's time that we got wise and figured out, you know, what it is we're doing wrong. And thank goodness for great writers, great thinkers, great investigators like Diana West, who are willing to go out there, publish this, and get us thinking and stay in the press every day like she does as a syndicated columnist for UClick, which means her articles are picked up by all kinds of online newspapers, and they are read by literally millions of people every single hour, so that we gain a better perspective. Why is that important? That's what I want to go into in this hour with Diana, because we are at the threshold of another war, another involvement of American lives and American assets for some grand plan that I don't think any of you understand. So let's see if we can gain some understanding. Diana, in our last interview, I had asked you the question, at the end of the Cold War, when the Soviet wall was torn down and unification happened and we thought, oh, gee, you know, now we're not facing a nuclear threat anymore, there weren't a lot of for sale signs in Washington, D.C. In other words, these thousands of Soviet agents, now multiple generations of them in Washington, didn't leave. They didn't go away. And now we're reading about the great world hero with his shirt off and his camo pants and his high-powered rifle writing op-ed pieces and literally patching a peace process together that the Nobel Peace Prize winner himself couldn't do. What is going on in D.C. right now?
Well, I wish I could tell you. It does feel very ad hoc and rudderless. I think our branches of government seem out of whack and dysfunctional, and namely the Congress, which had really, since again going back to Roosevelt, had increasingly lost its way in terms of being a check on executive power in terms of foreign involvement. And Right now, they're
largely because isn't that largely because Congress writes this law, and then the agencies which Roosevelt established, and now there are many more of them than there used to be, EPA, FDA, you know, the CIA, the FBI. I mean, there's just dozens of administrations, bureaus, you know, these agencies that literally run the entire world with regulations that have the force of law. Congress has no clue what those agencies are doing, and they are run by secretaries who are the cabinet members appointed by the president.
Right.
So it's the executive running everything.
Yeah, no, that's very true in terms of the bureaucratization of power. That is very, very true. It seems to me, though, that Congress, given that they are sent by, you know, they're our most direct form of representation, sent by the people to represent them, that when the president moves toward war, toward deployment of actual armies that come from our people, that they do still have a very direct line back to the folks at home and to the president in order to be that balance, in order to question, is this in American interest? And that is where they seem to fall down every time. They don't seem to gain critical mass on this. We go back to the Libya adventure back in, I guess it began in 2011. We did see a couple of congressmen, that would have been Representative Walter Jones, a Republican, and Dennis Kucinich, a Democrat, trying to actually take the president to court over illegally taking us to war. And it was thrown out. It didn't go anywhere. There was no support from the leadership of the House. There seemed to be, I remember this very distinctly, there almost seemed like there might be, and then of course there was some deal cut that we know nothing about that drained that energy out of the balloon. And it, once again, you know, there is now kind of a dance going on. We don't really know where it's going. It meanwhile becomes a tremendous distraction from all of the truly pressing threats coming at us domestically, whether it regards amnesty, our border, Obamacare. I mean, everything's on hold right now. And again, you wonder if there's some kind of giant act of misdirection going on as well, in terms of everything focusing now on Syria. And again, you say, well, what's the American interest there? Do our congressmen, does our president even have American interest in their you know, bag of tricks in terms of how they get up every day and decide to do their job? I mean, this is how far away I think we've gotten from being a constitutional republic with an American interest, with national borders. It really becomes a matter of where does the world policeman go next, and is that really what the American people want to do again? And it seems like the answer is no. But is there a big gulf between what the people say and what the legislators do and what the president ultimately decides? I mean, this is where it seems like we really are very broken.
Well, I think you're correct with respect to a representative government. And that's the point that I think is so important, is that this government that has now really got legs and arms and an entirely confiscatory budget is now 80 years old, and it runs everything. It writes all the regulations. It writes the taxes. It takes the enforcement actions. It decides which laws are going to be enforced and which ones are not, and how they're going to be enforced, how the regulations are interpreted according to the secretary. And we have no representation in that government. And it is actually, and most Americans don't know this, it's actually illegal for Congress to involve themselves or even ask those agencies any questions outside of a formal hearing. And I think the American people have seen how successful those formal hearings have been, from Fast and Furious to IRS to, I mean, just go down through the list. The agencies will answer nothing. They will hand you a stack of sheets of paper that have nothing but black from top to bottom, and then they'll smile at you and take the fifth and walk out and go right back to work. There's nothing Congress can do. So I'm saying that we're at this point where we were, say, 15 years after the agencies were put in place by Roosevelt, where the agencies are moving American assets around And Congress has no idea what's going on, where the money's being spent, where the money's being starved out of programs, a la the South Pacific war effort during World War II. I don't think that was directed out of the White House. That was directed all out of the agencies. And I think we can make this clearer with your perspective on Lend-Lease. What was Lend-Lease? How was it used? And more importantly, how was it abused during World War II and the Cold War?
Oh, yeah. Well, that's a great topic. I would like to say one thing, which is I do think that Congress is a little bit like Dorothy and the Wizard of Oz in that Congress can click its heels together three times and come up with some select committees that have all manner of investigative powers, power of subpoena, hire real investigators, not just committee staff. They actually could do a whole lot more than they do. So they need more backbone in terms of asserting themselves. If you go back in the 40s and 50s, you see tremendous investigative committees set up. You know, we go back to the Watergate Select Committee. I mean, there you can do a lot with the Select Committee. But on to Lend-Lease, because it is a fascinating, another little-known chapter to most people, because I actually looked in my daughter's history book, their AP history for, I guess, junior year high school book, one line about Lend-Lease. And what Lend-Lease was a program that was voted into law in the March of 1941. And it was essentially designed or presented to the American people as a means to keep out of the European war. It was going to be a way of funding our allies so that they could fight and we could stay home. So this is actually how it was presented. That wasn't, of course, what happened, but that was the presentation. But the really key thing to remember about what the Lend-Lease Law did, because I think it really is another sea change, just as 1933 in our alliance with the Soviet Union was a sea change. In 1941, Lend-Lease gave the President of the United States practically supreme power by giving him the power to choose whatever ally in the world he wanted to supply with whatever manner of supplies and money he wanted to supply. No questions asked. He could set the terms of repayment or not. It was truly a executive power amplification that was unprecedented. And it placed in the hands of Roosevelt in the White House this essentially treaty-making power, all manner of things taken again from the Congress, choosing friends, choosing enemies, and indeed setting policy. This became a method of supplying the British, the Chinese, the Soviet Union, now, and other allies, now against Nazi Germany, against Imperial Japan. Now, the interesting thing was that the American people did not want to supply Soviet Russia. They were not interested. Now, of course, at this time when the law passed, the Soviet Union and Nazi Germany were allies. That didn't change until later, in June of that year. But this was, I think, always designed with Soviet supply in mind, but I can't really prove that. But I do know that the progenitors of the Lend-Lease Bill actually were people very much assets of the Soviet Union, and that would be Armand Hammer, and that would be Harry Dexter White writing in the Treasury, and it would be Harry Hopkins, again, Roosevelt's right-hand man. And they were the ones who really got the ball rolling on Lend-Lease. And when we flash forward to a point where the Soviet Union is attacked by Germany in June of 1941, Soviet aid begins. And this aid would become so massive that it was like a vacuum cleaner. It was like a Sears catalog and, you know, Pentagon roster of goods and all manner of goods, including consumer goods, including all manner of post-war goods, things like switchboards and railroad tracks and factories and oil refineries and boats, icebreakers that you could ply the icy waters of the Arctic to keep the gulag fresh with slaves. I mean, all manner of stuff. Of course, planes, of course, boots, of course, but also dress goods and almost a million miles of copper wire. I mean, the reams of stuff go on and on and on in terms of what we supplied. And all manner of patents. There were the House committees determined after the war. There were thousands and thousands of patents, secret plans, all manner of inventions, and and were moving towards a very interesting supply, which was uranium. Uranium shipments went to the Soviet Union during World War II under Lend-Lease, even after the Manhattan Project got up and running and General Groves, who led the Manhattan Project, put an embargo on uranium exports in order to keep them from the Soviets. Well, they went out anyway. And this is what became a great scandal after the Soviets blew up their own atomic bomb after World War II in 1949. And there were actual congressional hearings on the subject. Someone very intimately involved with Lend-Lease, an Army major named George Racy Jordan, who had been an Army expediter, he was the head guy at the big air base in Montana that was pushing stuff along the pipeline to the Soviet Union, mostly planes and all these goods that would go through and all these diplomatic, unbreakable diplomatic mail, huge suitcases and so on, thousands and thousands of pounds of stuff would go through. Anyway, after the war, after the Soviets exploded their bomb, he became very conversant with what had happened, and he realized he had exported uranium. He had not only exported uranium, he had exported some 23 atomic materials and lots, thousands and thousands of pounds of aluminum tubing, something like 13 million pounds, I think it was, of aluminum tubing, which, of course, is very important in the whole procedure. So he testified before Congress. He was corroborated by investigators. They found the bills of shipping. They found the plane numbers. They got the pilots who said, oh, yeah, I remember that funny granular brown stuff I was shipping. I mean, it was really confirmed dead to rights that this had gone on. But the very sensational claim he made, which only he could make, was that Harry Hopkins, again, the president's right-hand man, had been intimately involved in pushing this uranium shipment through, that one in particular that flouted the embargo. And, of course, Harry Hopkins was dead at this time. But Jordan was proven correct on so many counts that I think he becomes a very credible witness to saying that Harry Hopkins called him up, asked to make sure that this uranium went through. Oh, and heavy water went through as well. I mean, this is something else the Congress is able to put on the record, that yes, this is true. And, you know, you really have to wonder about this. Harry Hopkins was the head man in Lend-Lease, and he was the most pro-Soviet, if not an agent of Soviet influence, man in the administration. So these things become very disturbing as we know about the race for the atomic bomb and we know about the Soviet penetration of the race for the atomic bomb. So these become, again, very disturbing questions. But my first question was, when I read about this, Brooks, was why don't we know about what Major Jordan said? Why don't we know about these hearings that discovered that, yes, uranium and heavy water and all this stuff had gone through the Soviets during World War II when we were supposed to be in this race for the atomic bomb? What happened to that history? Who wrote the history so that they wrote this incredible story out? And that sort of was what gets me going, so I start digging at that point.
Well, I couldn't agree more. I mean, I think about your daughter's history book again, and I think about, oh, yes, we found who gave the Soviets that terrible information. It was the Rosenbergs. We found them. We executed them. End of story. But it wasn't the Rosenbergs. It was Soviet agents working inside of agencies of the United States that was shipping. These agents were shipping, as you said, 30 million pounds of aluminum tubing, which are used for the
13, I think it was, yeah. Mm-hmm.
To enrich the uranium. It's for slamming neutrons into the uranium to get it
right.
to weapons grade. Now, you fast forward to today and you watch what's going on. Now, obviously, with our social networks and our satellite and lots of investigative reporters around, we can't ship stuff directly from the United States to Syrian rebels. But we can confiscate them from a country like Libya, who we assist in pounding the crap out of. And then once those weapons, rockets and grenades and missiles and all state-of-the-art, because Muammar Gaddafi could afford the very best, all that stuff goes instantly on the black market, is instantly transported to Turkey, comes across the border into Syria to feed who? Well, it looks like another Lend-Lease type and shadow. It looks like we're feeding CIA operatives from Chechnya and Pakistan and Al-Qaeda to fight against the Syrian government. But as I played Mr. Topley's interview earlier, right before you came on, he went there and he talked to people in the hospitals. He talked to people in refugees that came from there. And it sounds like most of Syria supports the Syrian government. They're actually quite tolerant of all kinds of different factions of people. And there's nothing even like a civil war going on there. What's happening is that conscripts are coming in, sitting in the buildings, and they're sniping people off the streets. And that's where the 100,000 dead came from. We're actually feeding the weapons to the snipers who are killing the civilians.
It's incredible. I mean, I still get stuck on just the notion that we could possibly be supporting Al-Qaeda. I mean, I just get stuck on that. We've been doing this since Libya, at least in this current cycle, and just, you know, find it obscene. And especially when, you know, you have this all sort of culminating around another grim anniversary of 9/11, and you just wonder, how do we get to this point where we are even broaching the topic of supporting extremely intense jihadist Muslim Brotherhood, Al-Qaeda elements to take over what is now really, I think, widely considered the central front of jihad in the world today, namely Syria, from a government that, again, not a great government, not happy, you know, not a fan of Assad by any stretch of the imagination, not a fan of Hezbollah, et cetera, et cetera. However, as you point out, it has been a secular government, and he has had chemical weapons for decades and never, for example, threatened Israel with them. Now, if you sweep in this new crew with American help, again, I just can't even fathom this, you sweep them in, all of a sudden you have a situation where you may expect chemical weapons to be used against Israel, for example, and you will have a situation where it will probably be incumbent on Americans to lead some kind of strikes on these chemical stocks, because they are being weaponized and deployed, that will cause innumerable or much, you know, tremendous collateral damage in the act of trying to destroy them. I mean, it becomes, and all the unintended consequences that I can't even possibly think of while we're having a conversation, but you never know once you start destabilizing areas what happens next. We look at Libya, for example. We destabilize, and then Libya gets taken over. And then what happens? We start seeing all manner of terrorism in other surrounding countries, Algeria, you know, the spillover, of course, as you talk about, into the weapons pipeline and so on, these guns and these man pads and all this stuff is all over the place, you know, in Gaza and God, goodness knows where, all over the place. So, again, American force projected for what, doing what, causing what, it becomes absolutely out of control. And again, the American people seem completely out of touch with it, which is probably the way the actual government elites want it. I mean, we just don't seem to really focus and care too much. And I guess that is how these things go forward. And, you know, what to do about that, I do not know. But it does seem like something is terribly wrong when 12 years after 9/11, we don't really bat an eye at the notion of our CIA supporting Al-Qaeda.
Well, that's true. And I know it's easy to say, we don't know, we can't guess. But that's the whole reason why we study history like this. Not the history that's on the glossy white pages that you get in your history book in your high school, because those have already been sanitized. The winners have already written that history. I'm talking about the great, real, factual history that you put in your book and others like you, so that we can look at it, and with that hindsight, we can look forward and say, wait a minute, you know, those in power have lied to us before. And when all the press rings out like a choir in harmony with one another, oh, it's Assad that has used gas against his own people. And then you have, what, the likes of Vladimir Putin saying, hold on, wait a minute. Yeah. Assad has nothing to gain by using this. He's winning. He's beating the quote, rebels, or the ones that are fighting against him. He doesn't need to use gas, especially against innocent civilians. So who gains by this, Vladimir says in his ostensive op-ed piece? he says Al-Qaeda gains by it. So Al-Qaeda does it, blames it on Assad, or shall let's just cut to the chase. The CIA does it, blames it on Assad. The press is complicit in making that report. The American people call up their Congress, hey, let's go give Assad 30 days of it, just like we did in Bosnia, and everything will be all right. No one will ever use chemical weapons again. Who wins? Al-Qaeda wins. And that just scares the heck out of everybody, because now you go from a secular government to a fanatical religious government that doesn't mind cutting the heads off of parents while their teenage kids watch.
Yeah, I know. It just boggles the imagination. Honestly, I really struggle with trying to make sense of these events, because you just can't. It just doesn't seem possible to do. I don't understand it, and I I'm not shedding much light on it, because it is, especially the way you just said it, it is utterly staggering. It becomes, you know, a real wonderment, particularly when, for example, we have no border between Arizona and Mexico. It is completely the domain of these transnational criminal enterprises that once upon a time, back in the good old days, were just drug cartels. I mean, it is now absolutely no longer American sovereign soil. It is badlands. And, you know, that goes on absolutely unreported, unstopped. And you wonder, and then the president talks about, you know, and some sort of strikes on Syria, which may be followed by who knows what kind of an investment of actual boots on the ground. And you think, hey, why don't we have boots on the ground in Arizona? What is going on? I mean, this is the kind of chaos we are in. And again, we're not being told the truth about. It again is utterly mind-boggling when the American interest is no longer at our leaders' hearts. And that, a tragedy.
Yeah, and we have some in the major media. Not many. I think Sean Hannity stands out by himself saying, okay, I'm all for some kind of path to citizenship after we secure the border. And he will not budge on that.
Yeah.
And I think some of the congressmen won't budge on it. But when I see the likes of Marco Rubio saying, well, let's do amnesty first, and then we'll clean up the border. And then I see the former vice presidential candidate, whose name escapes me right at this moment.
Paul Ryan.
Say, yes, I think that's a good idea. Let's find out where people are now. Let's get them driver's licenses, get them into school, get them health care, get them some minimum voting rights, and then we'll clean up the border. I'm floored by this. Absolutely out of my mind, stymied. I don't understand. Just like what you said, we're willing to send boots on the ground in Syria to pick up all the old chemical weapons left over from the 60s or 70s, but we won't put boots on the ground in Arizona and protect Phoenix from an all-out invasion.
Yeah, it's so true. And, you know, again, you know, you probably have to follow the money. You probably have to follow, I mean, you know, this the drugs and the human trafficking and everything else. I mean, it's multi-billion dollar business at this point. So you have to start following the money and wondering why we don't target the monies of these cartels, why we just, you know, have border agents still looking for massive seizures of drugs. I mean, they can pick up any amount of any drug you can possibly imagine and you know, call in the press and say, look, we just got bazillion pounds of meth or marijuana or whatever it is. They never, ever go after the money. And that is the only way you can ever stop these kinds of enterprises. But, you know, you have to say, well, why? Why, you know, and you have to say, well, how corrupt really are we? How corrupt is the, you know, just to stick with Arizona, the Arizona delegation, not to be demanding as a point of a national emergency, boots on the ground at their border. What's wrong with them? What's wrong with the rest of the Congress? I will never forget this summer when the Senate, it seemed they actually, you know, they seem to come together to say the border doesn't really matter anymore. I mean, it's you know, it's a real crisis in America, just in terms of remaining a sovereign country. And then you go to the point, well, it doesn't really look like they don't want to remain a sovereign country. You know, this whole notion, getting back to our 80-year Roosevelt forward kind of progression, we are moving toward this globalism, toward this non-sovereign kind of status. And, you know, then our involvements every other place start to make more sense in terms of squelching a problem here, asserting dominance there in order to have some kind of, I don't know, some kind of global accommodation with these various groups in order to what? The flow of money, the flow of oil, the flow of what? Drugs. I mean, it becomes such an ugly, ugly picture farther and farther away from, yes, our dear old constitutional republic, and farther, farther away from our concept of sovereignty. And I think these have been things that have been undermined desperately ever since, particularly ever since the 1930s. I mean, yes, there was progressivism and so on before that, but again, you really can see a sea change going forward with Roosevelt, the formation of the United Nations. I mean, it goes on and on, and we are definitely being eroded from within to a point where what will citizenship be? Do we have citizenship? Is it even a concept anymore? Do we teach it? No. I mean, these are the kinds of really systemic issues that I guess do play into what we read every day in the newspapers and need to sort of connect it all.
Yes, well, it has been an 80-year process, and we have seen now, just now, in the last 5 years, now over 50%, in fact, over 60% of the population of the United States is now, in some way or another, working for the state. They are now state employees. They are bought, they are paid for, and their income depends upon their vote. Now, when you ask the question academically, why the heck doesn't Arizona protect itself from this invasion? A, they're not allowed to by federal law. B, the National Guard that the governor would normally have control over in these kinds of situations is serving in Afghanistan protecting poppy fields for the Taliban.
Yeah.
The heroin that's made from those poppy seeds has ended up in Charlotte, not far from where I am, for the first time in my lifetime. We are seeing people die from heroin in our own city, and it comes from Afghanistan. Heroin on the streets. Now, in the 60s, we heard about that, but it was little labs here and there around the country. This is global heroin that's being exported out of factories in Afghanistan, and those factories and those poppy fields are protected by American troops. I've spoken to the soldiers myself. They're guarding it to stabilize the economy, they say.
Yeah. It's again another one of these wonderments of our time. Yes, it's absolutely true. They do that. I haven't spoken to any. I've certainly read about this and seen quite a lot of pictures. I do remember it was Hamid Karzai who did not want us to do anything to disrupt the poppy growers in Afghanistan, and of course, you know, his family involvement in the drug
trade is legendary. His brother was running it, and when his name was finally made public, they shot him.
Yeah. No, it's again. You look at the money; it becomes the real threat to us all. Really, this intense corruption at the very highest levels. It does demand a very interventionist Congress to actually deal with these problems. We do have the mechanism to do it, but we do continue to have, with minority exceptions, we do tend to have these very do-nothing Congresses who go along, rubber stamp, are cowed into participation with mavericks, you know, bless them all, the mavericks we do have who try to stand up and try to coalesce some votes for some of these more liberty-affirming policies and responsibility, but that is kind of where we are as a country, and it isn't enough just to blame Congress. Congress is a reflection of the people. So it is something that we all need to kind of rediscover in ourselves in order to hope to see it mirrored in our Congress, but we are desperately adrift.
We are adrift, and I think that the value of history, really accurate history, all of its dirty laundry, I think it provides us that rudder so that we can steer the ship of the United States or steer the ship of the free peoples of the world away from the rough waters. If we don't have history, real history to guide us, we're on a rail going somewhere that we have no no alternative. We can't have control. We can't use our wisdom to avoid Armageddon, I'm afraid.
I think you're right, and I guess with what came to me, you know, American Betrayal was several years in the making, and what it finally occurred to me when I realized I really was rewriting. I mean, it sounds kind of like an outrageous thing to try to do, but I was really rewriting 20th century history, American history. In fact, after I first spoke to you about the book, I got an email from one of your listeners. And remember, we actually had a three-hour conversation about the book that night. It went the whole show, I think. And I got a man wrote me and he said, you know, I listened to the whole show, and what I get from this is this. What you're saying is that all of post-1930s history, strategic, military, diplomatic history, essentially, is a fiction. And I remember sort of, you know, we talked 3 hours, right? And this is how he boiled it down. And I remember I wrote him back and I said, you know, you're right. That's exactly it. That's what I was saying in 3 hours. That's exactly right. But the point is that the reason I was able to rewrite was by bringing in the intelligence history, bringing in the history of the dirty Soviet intelligence war waged by American proxies that is never incorporated into the histories we're taught at school. So this was sort of the mechanism why everything looks different. But what occurred to me as I was working through this was you can't possibly work responsibly and morally until you write the history, until you try to, I mean, R-I-G-H-T, make the history correct, take the lies down, and put all the pieces together, no matter how much they will break your heart, because a lot of this is very heartbreaking stuff. It is heartbreaking to learn about corrupt leaders, to learn about lost men, to learn about battles that never had to be fought, and so on. So without doing that, short of doing that, I think we are doomed, perhaps not to repeat, maybe to do things even worse, but certainly not to understand why it is we are operating the way we do. And I would say that the two major symbolic changes that American Betrayal, I think, ultimately is calling for, essentially, is Franklin Roosevelt slips off his pedestal quite a lot in the course of this book. And I think the great investigators who are looking into communist subversion, including Joseph McCarthy, come up from the hell of history. In other words, there's sort of like a flippage going here when you actually lay all the facts out, that the investigators were not really looking at a red scare as an imaginary thing, but a red reality, sure. And that Roosevelt, before them, was presiding over this tremendously damaging, destructive subversion that continues through to this day. I mean, how can we say we won the Cold War when our colleges are outposts of Marx and you have House Republican majority that can't even muster the votes to defund socialized medicine? I mean, something changed here. And this, I think, is why you have to just churn everything up again and take another look.
Yes, and it goes, I think, beyond that. Not only are they pushing socialized medicine through, which was one of the great ways that Europe was brought under the thumb, but now they're pretty much defunding secondary education. We have a lot of high school kids that don't graduate with degrees. They have to get jobs at minimum wage. They end up dependent upon the state and thus, you know, what I call professional voters. And then we have college students who get into college, either can't afford the loans or, like has happened in the last 18 months, and I know this because I have a kid that's in college as a senior now, the Pell Grants were exhausted. I mean, they were exhausted early in the year, like May for the year, for the 2013-2014 school year, which has never happened before. I got Pell Grants when I went to college. So the Pell Grants were exhausted. And the what's called the FAFSA, which is the way you have to apply for federal funds for education now, all got stopped up, and everybody had to return in all of their tax information all the way down to what's called a tax transcript. Well, what this did is it bought the federal government time. It bought them months of time, like they were out of money. But it also frustrated virtually uneducated parents who had kids in college that could not understand the paperwork or the application process, and so their kids dropped out. Oh. They dropped out of college because they could not figure out the process. And so you have an attack on both sides. You have a squeezing down of educated young people who are really the lifeblood of the future of any country. You have the literal importation of armies of PhDs into this country who come in under a special visa as educated foreigners, most of them Indian, Chinese, Pakistani. They come into this country, and if it wasn't for them, we would have no high-tech industry in this country because we're not putting out the graduates. We're not putting out the brains that it takes to take our country to the next step. And if you add to that the fact that our national sovereignty, from our borders to our foreign policy, has a complete lack of leadership, we're in real trouble. And when I say leadership, when Roosevelt came into office, the nation had fallen apart. It had been smacked down with the Depression. And he came in with, like, government in a box. Here were these, you know, 18 agencies that he magically formed with budgets and guidelines and work procedures and policies. Like, it had been laid out for years in advance, which it probably had been. But that agency group grew over the next 80 years to literally run the country. They run everything. They run everything from our air to our water to our utilities to the flow of money, the way we move our money, how we travel. They control everything now. We don't have the liberties that we had then. And so we have, as Diane said, we had some brave Americans who decided to run on that platform. Hey, we're spending ourselves into bankruptcy here. And they called themselves the Tea Party for that reason. And they have been excoriated in the press. They have all but just been gutted as a caucus in Washington. And I doubt anyone will really run under the Tea Party in this next election. And if you add to that the fact that you have a professional voter class, and I've said this before on the program, Diane, it's insidious, and I hate that I had to think of it. But if the administration really got desperate, all they'd have to do is cut the food stamp cards off for a couple of weeks, blame it on the Republicans, and the last free election would happen that year.
Yeah. Well, that's true. It's true. I think that and you forgot, of course, the IRS going after the Tea Parties.
That's true.
With investigations, and then, of course, with amnesty and waves of cheap labor, really quasi-slave labor. I always think of it as the most immoral kind of labor when businesses exploit labor from Mexico and other countries like that. But that, again, is another blow on the American worker in terms of depressing wages. Again, that's another buffeting that our leadership thinks is wonderful, I guess, because of the businesses that find that a delightful prospect. Yeah, no, it's a real bind. And again, you know, you just wonder how you possibly climb out of any of this stuff. It is a real conundrum.
There is a way. It takes a leader that will step forward, that will surround himself with secretaries of integrity who will go into those agencies and interpret those regulations in such a way that the economy can begin to grow again, that people can begin to have dignity and sovereignty over their own life condition. But I don't see that leadership anywhere in present-day Washington, D.C.
Yeah, well, I am a fan of Ted Cruz. I think he has a lot of moxie, but he's only one person. It's very difficult. I know, you know, he's been very involved in the movement with I guess Senator Lee and some others to try to defund Obamacare and work on that that strategy. But again, you know, you end up with what, a dozen, 15 senators at the most. I mean, it's very, very small potatoes. I don't know. It all does seem to come to kind of a break point. You just wonder, well, what happens when the money is gone, when the money doesn't flow, when everyone is a professional voter, as you say, and on the government dole or on the government payroll, however you want to put it, and there aren't enough producers anymore. I mean, it just becomes, you know, at a certain point, I guess we do hit that tipping point too. But yeah, it does take a leader of conviction. You know, when you were talking, I was thinking about Mitt Romney, who did not want to defend himself against all manner of charges, including whether he had murdered a woman who had been in his employ. If you remember that little gambit, but also when that whole point about, you know, the 50%, the 40% who are not paying taxes, he did not want to discuss that with the American people and how dangerous that is to our health. As a country, as a free country, as a capitalist country, as a free market country, he didn't want to ruffle the waters. Again, getting back to this notion of we mustn't offend the X, whether it's the Muslims, the Russians, the low-income voters, this notion of not offending and thinking that things are going to work themselves out if you don't identify problems and discuss them bravely is really part, I guess, of our current condition, which is a very cowardly condition, of being afraid of being clear and forthright and frank about these problems. And I, you know, this again, I guess, would go to our change in character that has probably been, you know, one of these other century transformations to a point where people are afraid to talk about anything. And again, when you don't talk about things, you also stop thinking about them. And so they just disappear from the radar screen as you, you know, walk off the cliff. So it you know, again, these are problems that go to the root of character. And I guess that means they're problems that individuals can begin to solve by overcoming in terms of character. So I guess there must be always hope, Brooks.
I think there is, but, you know, and I hate to be, you know, getting it darkest before the dawn, which is, I hope, coming in the next 8 minutes.
That's
but
right.
You look at character. I look at a man like Mitt Romney, who has literally spent his entire private life in service of others. And I think he's a very cheek-turning man, which means
you
can strike him hard across the cheek and he's not going to strike back. And then I look at the accomplishments of Barack Obama, and it's a blank sheet of paper. He never helped anyone. He never did anything for anyone. He was a nobody that did nothing, sponsored nothing, wrote nothing. He was unremarkable in every sense of the word. And yet he rocketed to the top and stepped right over Hillary Clinton, who was, in all arguments, the most powerful woman in the world at the time. And you got to think something else is going on here.
Yeah. Well, you know, I agree with you. Mitt Romney was probably one of the most decent men to run for public office that, you know, we can remember probably in terms of his own personal character and his own accomplishments. But I think that there really was a failure there that I hope others do learn from in terms of not taking things on, thinking that, you know, it was okay just to run as a great businessman and a man of decency, but not defending himself was one, and then not defending the country in terms of that was, of course, when we had the very massive firestorm over Benghazi developing that he certainly clearly made a strategic decision not to take on. And that lets everybody down. And you know, I understand, you know, these people are constantly worried about what the press will say or what the other pundits will say and so on. But that, again, is not leadership, because you have to go full steam ahead and go over the heads of those echo chambers that are always going to be taking down people for these kinds of, standing up, really, for the American people, which, you know, you're not supposed to do. So it does, again, become, I hope, an object lesson for others who want to step forward, because you just have to go for it, and you have to just be brave, and you have to stand up. You will probably win that way, but you do not win by taking the safe road. And, you know, it is to all of our losses that he did not win, and it is just an amazing measure of the country that he was not the choice. But, you know, I don't think he went hard enough for it.
Well, I think there were other forces at work too. I look at the 9 precincts in 2 states where Romney did not get a single vote, and I'm a statistician, And I can tell you that that is statistically impossible. Almost impossible. The odds
so
against
why didn't,
the...
So why didn't he make a stink? You know, then the Republican Party needs to make a stink. They always abdicate in these situations. It seems like Republicans constantly are conceding all manner of corruption. And I agree with you. There were tons of stories like that. You know, that would have been a tremendous service to the country for Mitt Romney to make a stand on this kind of dirty election, really, epidemic. That did seem to emerge anecdotally. That would have been a fantastic thing to set up some kind of commission to actually go into these precincts and these districts and look at the voting, look at the practice, certainly to safeguard it for next time. But again, just this abdication because it's suddenly, oh, that may not be good for the country. Well, you know what? It's not good for the country to have dirty elections.
Well, that's true. And I'm heartbroken because there are no investigative reporters, not with Drudge, not with Breitbart, not with Newsmax or WorldNet Daily, that are going door to door in those precincts and asking people, did you vote for Romney? That person is going to answer the door and say, my God, I thought you'd never ask. I voted for him. And they find 2,000 votes for Romney and they go, hey, what's going on here?
Well, there were
some pockets of, you know, some voter fraud, or maybe the machines didn't work right. Maybe they all voted for Obama in those nine districts. But certainly it didn't happen nationwide. It really didn't affect the election. And certainly the fact that all of the states that voted for Obama had no photo ID laws.
Right.
And the four key states that voted for Obama were flooded with Obama phones. There's no correlation there whatsoever.
Right. Right. Well, you know, again, it's just getting away from the responsibility. And you know, my first book was called The Death of the Grown-Up. I mean, there's a lot of that problem that we are constantly faced with. I just read today, I think it was in the Daily Mail of London, that the head of the NSA, General Alexander, had his top secret monitoring room designed to look like the bridge on the Star Trek Enterprise. I mean, that's a grown-up? I just couldn't believe that.
Oh, my goodness. So does he play the theme when he comes to the office every day?
They didn't get into that, but they, you know, I don't know how the Daily Mail got this story, but they often have very good scoops.
Yeah, they really do. They really do. If you have another half hour, I'd like to talk about some of the press that's been going out there about our friend Julian Assange and about Snowden and what that means, because that hadn't broken the last time that you were on the air about you know, all of the surveillance that's going on, not only in our country, but in other countries, other embassies, other foreign meetings, and what effect and what bombshells there are out there that may be coming, what effect that will have on writing the history of the future, if you'll stay another half hour with me.
Well, you know, I was going to say no, but I would love to talk about Assange and Snowden. So, yes, I'll stay for another half hour. Pleasure.
All right, we'll be right back. Give us about 4 minutes to rest our vocal cords. We'll be right back. Don't go away.
Well, I dreamed I saw the knights in armor come saying something about a queen. There were peasants singing and drummers drumming, and the archer split the tree. There was a fanfare blowing to the sun that was floating on the breeze. Looking Mother Nature on the run in the 21st century. Well, I was lying in a burned-up basement with the full moon in my eyes. I was hoping for a replacement when the sun burst through the sky. There was a band playing in my head, and I felt like getting high. I was thinking about what a friend had said. I was hoping it was a lie. dreamed I saw the silver spaceship fly in the yellow haze of the sun. There were children crying and colors flying all around the chosen one. All in a dream, all in a dream, the loading had begun. Flying Mother Nature's silver seed to a new home in the sun. Flying Mother Nature's silver seed to a new home in the sun.
Welcome back to X Squared Radio. If you're listening live September 15th, 2013, then I applaud you, because this is really a landmark interview. It's my second interview with Diana West, the great author of American Betrayal. If you haven't read the book, I highly suggest get to Amazon, order the book, and read it, because you need to have your history books amended, and you need to have your eyes opened as to what nations did in some of the most dark and terrible times of our planet, our modern planet. And the fact that we came through that as victors may not be everything that you heard about. And now we're in sort of, shall we call it, modern times. We're 80 years now after the agency government was born under Roosevelt in 1933. What was the CCC has now become the whole Human Health and Services Division. Our freedom to move around is now greatly truncated by Homeland Security and the TSA. If any of you have flown in the last 30 days, you qualify to call in this hour at 888-429-5471. And what has happened as this has unfolded over the last 80 years is that occasionally people dig into the records. They ask enough questions to warrant an experiment, to test the theory, to test the axiom or the postulate, to see if there's such a thing as truth, justice in the American way. And they dig back into the records, and that's what Diana West did in her book, American Betrayal. And the records showed a little different history than what you watched as Walter Cronkite would roll the reels in between movies that you watched as a kid. I know, I'm dating myself a little bit, but that's okay. But in this latter day, we have workers on different levels who have also taken up the banner that Diana West did, although she's a great journalist and an investigative historian. That's what I would call her. And they have decided to do this, but they work for those organizations. They see what's going on in their own organization, in their own agency, and they take action. Today we call them whistleblowers, people that say, hey, wait a minute, something is wrong here. We're doing something wrong, or my boss is doing something wrong, or my company is doing something wrong. And you would think that the American people would say, oh my gosh, we had no idea that was going on. Let's get in here, turn the lights on, clean these files out, and disinfect this place. But that's not what happens. One such man is Julian Assange. Now, as you know, he is a fugitive living inside of an embassy, may never see the light of day as a free man again. He has been accused on ridiculous, trumped-up charges for some personal thing that he did with a couple of prostitutes in, I believe it was Denmark. Ridiculous, just to get him out of the embassy so he can be extradited to the United States and incarcerated forever. Because Julian Assange did something unforgivable. He opened the laundry basket and he showed the world the dirty laundry, the communiques, the emails, the pieces of history, the photographs, the fingerprints, the DNA evidence, as it were, that maybe leaders of different countries, including the United States, weren't exactly doing the right thing. Now, what did they do? Did they go after the leaders that actually killed 20,000 people or gassed this person or poisoned this person or assassinated that person or stole this money? No. That was the crime. But they don't want to go after the criminal. They want to go after the person that discovered the crime, Julian Assange. Now, as you know, 2 years ago, we nominated Julian Assange for the Nobel Peace Prize. I doubt it will ever be awarded to him, but nonetheless, we nominated him. Late last year, we nominated another individual, or maybe it was early this year, and that was Ed Snowden. Here was a guy who worked inside the NSA, and he worked on the inside of the inside. He had access, and he very slowly, very carefully compiled a couple of truckloads of evidence. And then he very carefully covered his tracks and hid that material. And he slowly began to leak it out. And what sort of triggered my mind, as Diana mentioned in the last hour, one of the foreign newspapers, and I'm thinking about the UK...
Daily Mail?
Yeah, the Daily Mail. They do an interview with Ed Snowden, a video interview, and out it goes. And here comes some information about what the United States has done. Why they're eavesdropping on all of our telephone conversations. So let's, Diana and I are going to talk about this for about half an hour. What is the transformation between what is happening as history is being written right now, as these whistleblowers release the dirty laundry? What are your thoughts on this?
Well, my thoughts remain evolving on this, but my bottom line is that we need to know these things about our government. What Snowden was able to reveal about the United States government was an extensive secret structure, a superstructure, that the more we learned about it, the more it sounded like something out of the old Stasi of East Germany than what we imagined could possibly arise domestically speaking in the United States in terms, as you mentioned, of listening or of recording, I guess the way they put it, recording phone calls, recording emails, recording internet searches, and so on, and logging this information indefinitely on virtually all Americans. And I think that this was the most startling of the revelations that continue. I mean, they are all startling, and there's so many of them that we're probably a bit numb to them, and I'm sure I'm not up on the latest. I still try to figure out what my attitude is toward Snowden. I don't really know exactly what his motivations were. I don't know if perhaps he was under some kind of coercion in terms of, maybe he was approached by a foreign service. We don't really know if he, was helped or directed to do this kind of work. We don't really know that much about him. The poor man ends up in Russia and the Russian airport for all that time and now has some kind of temporary asylum. I really wouldn't want to be him. In terms of, I don't know what kind of conditions he's living under. I mean, are they shooting him up with, truth serum to grill him on everything he possibly... I mean, it's really out of our ken, really, in terms of how it started, where it's going, what's happening to him. But on the other hand, again, you come back to this notion of, are we better off for knowing our government is doing this? I think yes. I think very much yes. With Assange... Again, I don't really know, how he is motivated, who is pushing his buttons. I saw a very startling story in, I think it's from today, in the Houston Chronicle that is wondering whether WikiLeaks sold Snowden to the Russians, which is a really, it kind of plays with your brain in terms of they're so any kind of working with the Soviet Secret Service to get Snowden there. I don't know. Again, there's so many things we don't really know about this, but what do I go back to? How many times have I used WikiLeaks in writing columns? How many other newspapers that, have not supported Assange or Bradley Manning used the things that they released to write their stories? I mean, it's a strange set of events. I was really struck by something that Daniel Ellsberg, who of course was famous for releasing the Pentagon Papers back in the 70s, something he said about Stowe's situation in particular. He said that in the 70s, when he released the Pentagon Papers, he had, you know, he was, I guess he was underground for a short time, and he ended up, you know, being arrested, and then he was in some kind of legal jeopardy or, you know, court case and so on, I think for a period of a couple of years before he was finally cleared of that. And he said that this was Nixon's America, right? And he was a big political enemy of Nixon or opponent. He said he was allowed to live, you know, at home. He was allowed to lecture on college campuses. He was allowed to earn a living all during this period where he was in this legal jeopardy for this huge leak. And he said Edward Snowden could not do that in our America today. He could not be, you know, here in anything like the conditions that Ellsberg was able to live under back in the 70s, which I think is a really striking concept. And so then you take that to the point, well, where else could he have gone? I mean, people say, gee, he should have, you know, he should have done this in a more above board fashion, but I think he would have, you know, faced he would have faced incarceration like Bradley Manning had he not gone to a hostile country. So as you can tell, I'm kind of trying to work through what I actually, my actual feelings about the whole thing, but I keep coming back to the fact that this is important information, and maybe this is the only way we can get to it at this point in our history.
But I have watched, you know, very skillful interviewers, and I've been trying to get either one of them to come on this program since the beginning, but I've watched very skillful interviewers ask them questions on camera and on video, and on audio, and I find when they answer the questions, they answer them very straightforward with facts and figures and places and motivations and reasons, and their eyes don't move and their foreheads don't wrinkle. But when I watch someone like Hillary Clinton or Susan Rice or the IRS answer any question like, what is your name? You see this spiral energy. They're twisting, turning and deflecting. Look at John McCain, and you know, I spoke on the same venue with him back in 1996 at a Republican fundraiser. He was just a dry as toast old duffer then. Yeah. Now it's I don't even know the guy. I can't figure out where he's going or what his motivations are. And I do have a good feeling for what Edward Snowden's motivations are. I do have a good feeling for what Julian Assange's motivations are. They want this lack of liberty to be removed. They want the people to be free again. They want their governments, all governments, to stop having these secrets from their own people, to be responsible and representative of their own people. And I think that's an honorable thing.
Well, I agree that transparency is absolutely the goal, and certainly we classify, I mean, they classify paper clips at this point. I mean, it's utterly ridiculous, and then you look at the rise of this parallel security state in America that, of course, has ramped up since 9/11 to an incredible degree where you've got, I don't even know what the number is, it's over a million people now with these very high clearances. It is a very, very unhealthy situation because, of course, the flip side of that is that our security agencies and military have been stripped of all study, analysis, and consideration of jihad, of Islam, of the motivations of 99% of the terrorism that our security agents are supposed to be warding off. So you've got sort of like, you know, Alexander of the NSA, one of the officials was talking about, you know, well, in order to look for the needle of the haystack, we decided to get the haystack, meaning everybody's phone calls, messages, and so on. While the flip side, again, is this Sino-Islam policy that, of course, allows the incredible atrocity at the Boston Marathon to take place under investigators' noses because they're not allowed to look for it. So we've got a very weird thing happening here that any American comes up against every time they fly and every time they go through an airport and every time they, you know, take their shoes off and all of that dehumanizing stuff that we've been living with since 9/11. And you know, then we get these leaks, these massive leaks. I guess my questions still remain, you know, in terms of we never see WikiLeaks out of Russia or some of these other countries, and then we see Julian Assange with a Russia TV show. We see, you know, Snowden ending up in Russia. I don't know if, you know, that story is you know, goes anywhere, but it's an interesting theory. I have to say I do feel more more comfortable with Snowden in some ways, but then I guess I just still remain perplexed, and maybe it has to do with the massiveness and craziness of the story that they are unrolling for us. It's kind of like in the old days, you know, you get a defector from the Soviet Union, and it's very easy to applaud him and to value, you know, the knowledge he's bringing out. When you have a defector from your own country, I guess it's sort of there's some conflict there that's not quite resolved in terms of what, you know, where is he defecting from and to, and, you know, then you realize how our transformation is so far gone. If, again, an American defects and then tells the world about a Stasi state in America, you know,
but the thing that blows everyone's minds is he didn't defect to Montana or to Tennessee somewhere. He defected to Hong Kong, and then on to Russia.
He couldn't defect to Montana.
Exactly. What he's telling us is there is no safe place
in
this country from which to tell that story.
I know. I agree. I mean, I agree. It'd be interesting to know. I mean, theoretically, a whistleblower can get immunity from Congress. But I wouldn't expect that to take place.
I wouldn't either. And most congressmen that I have listened to on the news say, you know, that he's, you know, guilty of treason. Why? Because he's only telling us what you're doing to the American people. Yes, but what he's doing is he's divulging how we get our information, and that gives our enemies too much information. Well, as you said before, Nazi Germany said exactly the same thing. And they even used the same phrase. Of course, it was in German. They used to say, see something, say something. In other words, they employed neighbors to spy on neighbors.
Right.
And then they militarized their police, which is exactly what we're doing. And if you don't believe me, go look at any county you want, any county in the nation. Go look at their recruitment videos online for their police departments. I dare you.
What, just ramped up militarization, tanks, AKs, all that stuff?
Oh, yeah, armored vehicles. Yeah. They have either industrial rock or some, you know, here comes the boom music behind it. And you have these, I mean, the only thing missing, Diana, is the goose step.
Yeah. I recently watched, it's such a great movie, The Lives of Others, the German movie, about surveillance. It's about surveillance by a Stasi official of a writer who is having some unhealthy democratic leanings and involvements. And it is this gruesome surveillance of this man's life. And as the official is involved in surveillance, he actually becomes quite attached to the writer. And it's very affecting, moving movie. If you haven't seen it, it came out a few years ago. There were a couple things significant about it. One, it was I think it is probably the only serious treatment of the surveillance state, of the communist state, that has came to American theaters ever. And it comes from a German filmmaker, a fairly young German filmmaker to boot. But again, as I was watching it, I was reminded of these leaks we've had, these tranches of information brought to us by Edward Snowden. And you know, there is something so disturbing about the fact that it is America that he is describing. He is not coming from the Eastern Bloc to tell us about such a state. He is coming, leaving America, going to hostile countries to tell us what's going on in our own country. So it is a very destabilizing kind of situation. But, you know, again, vital information. What's going on with it? I don't know that we are seeing any check put on this. I suppose that the officials involved have been put on some notice, but, you know, is there a huge outpouring against it? From what I understand, young people in particular are not all that concerned about it because they're so used to revealing all on Facebook and other kinds of media like that, social media and so on, that they actually are not as driven crazy by the whole privacy issue and you know, personal autonomy issue as maybe older generations are. And that, to me, is another frightening piece of this because, of course, the Facebook and the other, you know, kinds of internet media and so on have been complicit with a lot of these government programs. So it's kind of like they condition you on a voluntary level to a point where the interference of the state is not a problem. And I, you know, I look around, oh, there was such an amazing thing on Orwell's birthday, I think it was in Holland, but I'm not sure, it was one of the European countries. There, some artists did a birthday party by putting little birthday caps on all, you know, little party hats on all of the surveillance cameras in a certain neighborhood and photographing them. That was their little art project, but it was fairly effective. You know, George, or maybe it was the anniversary of 1984, where they marked it with this way. But, you know, that's our reality. We live under surveillance. We don't seem to mind. I mean, I mind intensely, but, and I can tell you as well.
It's like, you know, even my generation or the one in between says, look, if you're not doing anything wrong, you know, what if you have to fear?
Yeah.
If you're not speeding or doing drug deals on the street or own a registered firearm or applying for a concealed carry, if you don't belong to the National Rifle Association, there's nothing to fear. They're doing it just to keep us safe.
Yeah.
It's all okay. Yeah. And then you see, as you mentioned earlier, the Boston bombings, where there were some 400 agents at that event doing a drill on a terrorist blowing a bomb up along the sidelines of the Boston Marathon. There were people on the roofs with binoculars. There were bomb-sniffing dogs. They had mock gurneys all set up. They were ready to do a big drill there. And here come these two kids with ostensibly homemade bombs in pressure cookers and backpacks. And I've seen the before and after photographs, and I see them before and after with the same backpacks, but then I see agents in khaki pants and black shirts, Israeli-looking agents who look like they're working with the government forces that are there doing the drill, who actually have backpacks before the bombing and don't have backpacks after the bombing, and their backpack matches the backpack that blew up. And then I'm saying, what the heck is going on here?
Well, I think there are a lot of things that were going on there that we have never been told about or that we learned about briefly and disappeared. And one thing I was following at the time had to do with the Saudi involvement. As you recall, there was a Saudi person of interest who ended up, oh my goodness, supposedly spirited out of the country. But then recently he was interviewed in the country. The Saudi foreign minister has an intervention in Washington. I mean, there was all manner of craziness going on to erase any sort of Saudi involvement. But what they did not erase was a terrorist assessment paper, and I forgot the actual term, but this particular person was looked at, investigated, and understood as a 3B terrorist threat, which is a serious high-level terrorist threat, and he was made to disappear from the investigation. And this, again, becomes, you know, you get a flashback, like an LSD-style flashback to 9/11, where you saw the Saudi intervention after 9/11, and, of course, you saw, you know, scores of Saudis flown out of the country so as not to be investigated, so as not to be questioned by the FBI and so on. So, you know, all manner of cover-up, all manner of gruesome secrets, once again, being sealed up by the government from the people.
Well, let's not forget about Saudi money and CIA involvement in destabilizing Syria by sniping people from these buildings.
So, yeah, well, you know, it's Saudi money, isn't it? Qatari money as well.
Right.
It's, you know, a whole conglom of that whole region of the world, and you know, it's been going on a very long time, and where is it leading us? What is this all about? Now we have Al Jazeera in America, another Qatari enterprise. It just doesn't seem to stop, and it is not healthy, I think is the best way to put it. It's just not a healthy development. But again, not really discussed, not really assessed. Where's Congress? You know, I mean, again, you know, we do have the mechanism, but we don't seem to use it.
Well, that's true, but half of Congress can't get a security clearance.
Yeah, well, how about the president?
Wow, that's a good hit. Yeah, I'm with you on that. Listen, my Earth Explorers, my guest has been Diana West. She's the author of American Betrayal. Her link will be up at our website at xsquaredradio.com. I will make the audio again for this interview free to her so she can link it on her website and put it wherever she wants to. By the way, I got some email from some of your fans from the last interview with high compliments. So
I'm
very pleased at that. They said you got to go a lot further, deeper, and wider on this program than you ever do before. And sometimes we give that latitude to authors and they kind of flounder, but you do not. You are a wonderful interview with tremendous amounts of information. And a lot of that information, you know, is in the footnotes of your book and maybe in between the lines, but it's so powerful. And I really, really appreciate you coming on the program.
Oh, thank you, Brooks. I really enjoy talking to you anytime. It's always a pleasure.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. And I'll continue to read your columns. You're doing a great job. And I think for what it's worth, Radish is a pinheaded academic.
Thank you. It's worth a lot, actually. Appreciate it.
All right. You have a wonderful week. I'll let you get back to your life. It's 10:30 in Washington, D.C. Sorry to have kept you up so late.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Hope to talk to you again soon. Take
All
care.
Right. Thank you, Diana.
Bye now.
Bye-bye. All right. We have roughly a half an hour left. We've gone through a lot of information. We covered roughly 80 years, probably 90 years of history. So I want your comments. Feel free to write me. I know a lot of you are not out there listening live. I have a couple of people Skyping me notes and some great thoughts, high compliments. Everyone thinks she's lovely, which she is. And if you read her columns, she has her photograph there with her columns. And I can tell you that she does a fantastic job. It's thorough. It's unopinionated. It's not commentary. Most of it is backed by fact or by good, solid conclusions drawn from those facts. And that's good scientific work. That's what we want to see. Our phone number here is 888-429-5471. You already know that if you're a BBS radio regular. There are more than 70 hosts. I don't know the exact number, but it's more than 70 hosts on various channels at BBS Radio. It is the largest single network of audio content in any 24-hour period on the planet. So if you really want to get out of the mainstream, which if you think about it, is the big body of water that flows downhill to the ocean. It carries all the dead stuff. If you want to really be a live swimmer, you need to get off into the tributaries and start swimming upstream. That's where X Squared Radio is, where the water is fresh, the viewpoints are open, the investigations are thorough, and this is where the mysteries of the universe and of the earth are explored to the nth degree. Earlier in the program, in the first hour, we talked about how the Arctic ice was increasing. It isn't increasing by a little bit. It increased by 67% in the last year. The Arctic ice never thawed this summer, even though it was another year of record temperatures, most of them low this time. So that means that it's now, this month, snowing on the snow, snowing on the ice, and it will continue to grow the Arctic ice. The red ice, which is the ice that stays year after year in the Arctic, had melted away to almost nothing through a series of wind patterns that changed the way the jet stream moves around the planet, moved warm air up into that area and at quite high velocity and broke apart some of the very large bodies of ice. Now, when you're dealing with open ocean salt water, it's very difficult to get ice, fresh water, to form unless you can get the temperatures down to the point where the snow is falling hard enough. It forms a layer of fresh water on top of the salt water before it has a chance to diffuse while it's nice and cold, and it freezes, and then it snows on top of that, and it continues to build. Now the ice is about 2 to 3 meters thick and growing, and if the jet stream stays the way it is right now, at least across North America, you're going to see these Arctic temperatures blow down through North Dakota, through Michigan, probably through Ohio, down through the Ohio Valley, the Tennessee Valley, the Cumberland, and probably not go back up until the Carolinas. So we are probably looking at least east of the Mississippi, we're probably looking at one of the worst winters that we've had in a while. You couple that with the fact that we have not had any hurricanes to speak of. There's one sort of knocking on the door of Mexico right now, but it's loosely formed, not very high velocity. It is well across the Gulf of Mexico, so it's not picking up the energy that it should from very warm Gulf waters. And it doesn't look like it's going to turn into anything but a tropical storm, maybe banging Cancun and Belize. You couple those two things together, and you have the makings for a prolonged, steady kind of weather pattern with the jet stream not being motivated to move anywhere. So these Arctic winds can come down from Alaska, across Canada, down through North America, and up the eastern seaboard. I look for temperatures 20 to 30 degrees lower than they were last winter. More snow, more like what we had in 2009. You remember, I think it snowed like 21 days in a row there. So I would prepare yourselves. One of the ways to do that, of course, is decent food storage. You can do that by going to one of our sponsors, which is the Food Investor. I highly recommend them. Lightweight, dehydrated food that is done with no preservatives. So if you're going to invest in something this fall for yourselves, for your kids, for your grandkids, you want to put some really nice Christmas present together, I would put together a food storage package and send it to them. That way, if something happens and they have to move, they have to relocate for some reason, maybe they have to travel from where they live to where you are or where their friends or family are, or if some disaster happens or power outage happens, which very well could happen, and I'll talk about that in just a second. They will not be a burden upon the federal emergency management folks. You don't have to worry about the federal government bringing them cookies and cocoa in a warm blanket. They can take care of themselves. Now, if you don't want to do the high-quality stuff from the Food Investor, then I would recommend just increasing your shopping bill just a little bit. Pick up canned goods, tuna from the East Coast, not the West Coast. Because of Fukushima, the tuna on the West Coast is contaminated. So you can also buy macaroni and cheese. You can buy rice. You can buy dried beans. You can buy hard red winter wheat, although I highly recommend buying a wheat grinder if you're going to do that, so you can make your own pancakes and bread and et cetera. But above all, buy what you eat now. Don't go out and buy some elaborate food storage with 50-gallon, 55-gallon drums full of stuff that you don't eat. First of all, I highly do not recommend the 55-gallon drums of anything. Because if you have to move and your car is not running or the federal highways have been confiscated by the government for essential services only, how are you going to move those 55-gallon drums? You want to have food storage that you could move in a backpack. Not one trip, maybe 30 trips. Maybe on foot, maybe by bicycle, maybe with a little red wagon or a hand cart. Some way to move that food around. You also need some way to store that in your house. Yes, you can put it in your garage, but I recommend a basement or an attic. Why? Well, because there are ordinances out there that will allow the government to go house to house and look for stored food. And one of those ways is to make you open your garage. If it's easy pickings, they're going to take it from you, and they're going to distribute it themselves. You're going to be looked at as a hoarder, and that food is going to be contraband. If you think of it that way when you get your food storage together, you'll be smart about it. So how would the power go out? I'm glad you asked that question. We got about 15 minutes. There is an organization, a private corporation called the National Electrical Reliability Corporation, the NERC. They get their money from the federal government and from other organizations, primarily from the federal government taxpayers. Right now, they are linking all of the power manufacturing, power distribution systems inside the United States together into one grid. It has been an ongoing process, but they're almost finished with it. The hardest part about it is syncing the frequencies, not just the 60 cycles per second, but the phases, because there are three phases in that electricity. Each phase is 120 degrees away from the other phase, and when they're tied together, they're very powerful, but when they get off, when they get out of sync, then they begin to destroy each other and generate a lot of heat and feedback. That's what the NERC is trying to coordinate. Now, in doing this, in creating this one almighty grid and one almighty central control system, they have created three vulnerabilities for themselves. One of those vulnerabilities is against cyber or physical attack. The second is against a phenomenon called pandemic, which is widespread illness that incapacitates people or kills them. And the third is against natural disasters, tsunamis, tornadoes, earthquakes, fires, and solar storms. As we read to you in the first part of the program today, the sun is absolutely quiet. The X-rays being put out from the sun, flatlined. The solar wind is as low as I've seen it, less than 400 kilometers per second. Almost no sunspots on the sun. This is not what solar scientists are expecting. This is the solar maximum, you know, M-A-X, maximum, okay? Not minimum, which is where we're at. The sun is now changing its polarity from north to south. We also have some players coming into our solar system, which are fairly active comets. One of these is Comet Ison. Now, it's rather small. It's not really going to come close to Earth. It's going to come very close to the sun. And maybe, just maybe, it will flare up bright enough to see with the naked eye, even maybe bright enough to see during the daytime. But it is pretty small. It's only a few kilometers across. Some people are saying it could come close enough to Mercury to cause some problems. Others say if it slingshots around the sun, loses a little bit of its weight during the process due to coming within 700,000 miles of the sun. That's pretty close. That's like right next door, folks. And it slingshots around and maybe the head completely evaporates or explodes. The tail, millions of miles long, will survive. And Earth will pass through that tail a few weeks later. So this is one of many. And the near-Earth objects are also of interest. And keep in mind that due to sequestration, which is an across-the-board budget cut, one of the systems that we use to detect near-Earth objects called the Space Shield, it is actually a pretty discretionary radar shield that can detect near-Earth objects not close enough to the Earth to do anything about, because they're too close at that time, but large enough to cause major problems. We can at least evacuate the areas that we think are going to be hit. That shield has been shut down. So we have our best early warning system not funded. They're going to fund Obamacare, but they're not going to fund the space shield. So there are some events that are coming. And by the way, don't forget that I believe it is November 13th, which is supposed to be the closest pass of ISON. They will be practicing blackouts, practicing actual real blackouts in the United States. And you know what happens when the government practices stuff? Well, the stuff happens. I've often said the next time they have one of their nuclear disaster drills in Charlotte, I'm going to the beach. So I want you to just do some thinking, some watching, and by all means keep listening to X Squared Radio. Some of you, not many of you, but some of you have allowed your subscriptions to lapse or have asked for them to be ended. I know times are hard. All I'm asking for is $2.50. It's enough to keep the lights on here. We make no money off X Squared Radio. I can promise you that. Those archives are what keep the lights on here. So if you're listening to this program on an archive, thank you very much because you are a subscriber. If you're listening to it live and you think you would like to listen to this as an iPod somewhere in the future or share it with a friend, please click on the subscription button at X Squared Radio and subscribe to the archives. Less than a 32-ounce soda a month, you can be listening to great authors like Diana West, who was on our program tonight, and in pretty high-quality audio anytime you like. And you'll have access to the author. You can write me any questions you want. I answer everyone. Everyone who writes me at bagnew@x2-radio.com gets an answer from me. Might take me a couple days, but I will get back to you. I promise you that. And you just don't get access to the host like that. You don't get access to George Norrie that way. You don't get access to any of the other big hosts that way. But you will get access to me. bagnew@x2-radio.com. I promise I will answer. I also wanted to reiterate on the North Pole Inner Earth Expedition. I mentioned this in the first hour. I will do so now again. It has been 7 years since, actually a little more than 7 years, almost 8 years since I joined the North Pole Inner Earth Expedition. In the fall of 2006, due to the untimely death of Stephen Curry, I accepted the position as expedition leader. And I have worked faithfully now for all these years. I have put many tens of thousands of dollars of my own money, and I don't know how many hours. I just don't keep track of such things, but I work on it every single week. I have traveled the world. I have lectured to hundreds of thousands of people. I have done countless interviews on the radio and television about this expedition, and I have done everything that I know to do. And so after these many years, I have found it necessary from a business point of view to resign as the expedition leader. I have done so with the board. They have accepted my resignation. I am definitely not over yet. I am going to support whoever takes the lead. The websites and all of the information that we have, including the entire database of all of you that have signed up to be participants in this, will be transferred to them, and it will be in good hands. I promise that the database will not be lost, that each and every one of you will be contacted when and if this magnificent expedition, what we consider to be the greatest expedition in history, will take place. I thank you very, very much for the wonderful, wonderful emails I have received over the years, the standing ovations, the handshakes, the hugs, everything over all the nations that I have visited and spoken to about this expedition. My heart is full of gratitude, and I wouldn't trade it for anything. It is still a passion of mine, but obviously with the 120 hours a week that we spend working on the electric vehicles. I just do not, I cannot do it justice. And any justice given to it takes away from my primary responsibility, my shareholders, and my employees. So it is with a heavy heart that I resign, but it is also with a heart full of joy and gratitude to have been part of it these many years. And I thank you so much. Again, if you want to write me, ask me any questions you want, write me at bagnew@x2-radio.com, and I'll be happy to answer your questions. If you would like to participate in leadership of the North Pole Inner Earth Expedition, I am sure, I am positive that the board would be happy to speak to you. So you can send me your information, and you know, I can tell you that it will be considered. Leadership in these kinds of projects, these nonprofit projects, usually occurs from the person that steps back last from the line. In my case, I was highly passionate about the project. I believed in it. I am a scientist, pure and simple. And although I have been attacked from various websites, I've been threatened. I've never backed down. I've never feared. I don't fear ignorance. I don't fear darkness. I don't fear the dark hearts out there that doubt science, that don't believe in science, that don't want to explore anything and only have opinions of doubt, darkness, and ignorance to express. I have met some of them face to face. I have told them the harm that they have done to science, the harm that they have done to treasured listeners and faithful people from around the world, Australia, Germany, France, Norway, the United States, Mexico, Canada. I've received mail and applications literally from every continent on the planet in support of this. As you know, we won the Genes of Galileo contest as the most exciting expedition ever aired in the country of Japan. So this is widely respected as something that needs to be done. It is breaks my heart that it never got funded. It wasn't for lack of trying. We tried everything we knew how to do. It just was financially not possible. And if it's not possible, it even attracts me more. I love specializing in the impossible. But to be attacked openly, baselessly, and mercilessly by the likes of, I don't even want to name his name, but if you Google my name, he comes up number one right now. So it'll give you an idea how insidious and dark and ignorant these attacks have been. Have they hurt my feelings? No, not really. Have they hurt my business? Yes, they have. They've cost us a tremendous amount of money. That's just the way things go when you believe in science. I hate it. I'm disappointed in it. But, you know, those are the facts. People have asked me, have I been, you know, threatened by government officials or has any men in black come and visit me? No. No, none of that has happened. The government's been fine with it. Even the polar Expedition Division of the National Science Administration has been fine with it. The Russians have been fine with it. The patrons have been fine with it. The film producing companies have just loved it. The scripts that we've written, the work that we've done, the lectures that we've done, tens of thousands of people have all been supportive of it. That's not the issue. The issue are the people that represent themselves as coming from inside the genre and who sit outside the struggle and criticize those who are trying to do something, and they make themselves money and they make themselves fame and they get themselves recognition. And that is sad. When scientists like myself work tirelessly for more than 30 years to build a reputation of solid scientific research, patents, trade secrets, industrial progress, tens of thousands of published documents, and some person can sit outside all of that and criticize you as illegitimate. It makes my stomach turn. And so, yes, this was part of my motivation for stepping down. But I'm not doing it for myself. I'm doing it for those that depend on me. So I hope you understand. You have any thoughts on it, you can write me at bagnew@x2-radio.com. Or you can call me at 888-429-5471 in the next 3 minutes, because we only have 3 minutes left. Don't forget that you can still get the word out. You can order the Amazon bestseller, Alienated Nation, either from Amazon, Barnes & Noble, anywhere where fine books are sold online, or you can order the book from the website at alienatednation.com. And if you order it from that website, you will get it autographed by me, and you get the entire book and audio for free. So if you're not a great reader, don't worry about it. I read it for you. You can take the copy that I send you, and you can hand carry it to your governor's political office. If enough of you do that, your governor may join the 39 other governors that have passed sovereignty acts, and maybe we can get this constitutional convention to happen. If we can do that, we can stop the agency government from destroying what I believe is the greatest nation to have ever existed on the face of the earth, the United States of America. If we can stop the agency government from destroying this country, we might be able to save the world. It's worth it. All you have to do is get the book into the hands of your governor. I cannot travel to your state and deliver these books, but you can. All you have to do is spend the simple $15, get the book in your hand, and take it to your governor's political office. You don't even have to take it to the Capitol. Just take it to one of his campaign offices. Take it to your congressman's campaign office. Get it in the hands of the campaign workers, and they will get it to the governor. I promise you, the amendments that are in this book will save the republic. If it was not so, Mark Levin would not have written his book, The Liberty Amendments, with exactly 9 amendments, just like Alienated Nation, taking on the same issues that Alienated Nation did, even the National Guard Amendment, guaranteeing governors complete sovereignty over their own National Guards, preventing the president from conscribing state militias for undeclared foreign wars. It is important. Let's take back the republic. I'll see you next week right here on X Squared Radio. Thank you so much for being part of the program. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. Peace, Earth Explorers.